and then you can release it.
The Loop was presented by Paul Farley and produced by Jeremy Grange. It was a BBC Audio Wales and West production for Radio 4. And next week, the Large Hadron Collider. BBC News at 6 o'clock on Saturday, the 22nd of November. This is Charles Carroll. Good morning. Allies of President Zelensky, including the Prime Minister Keir Starmer, are due to meet at the sidelines of the G20 summit in South Africa to discuss the draft US peace deal for Ukraine. Keir said that they would look at ways to strengthen the plan, which appears to be aligned heavily in Russia's favour. President Zelensky has said Ukraine is facing one of the most difficult moments in its history. But at the White House last night, President Trump said Mr. Zelensky would have to like the deal.
Well, at some point he's going to have to accept something. You know, he hasn't accepted. You remember right in the Oval Office not so long ago, I said, you don't have the cards. Don't forget, I inherited this war. I would have never, this war never would have happened. I inherited this war. And I thought he should have made a deal a year ago, 2 years ago.
One of President Trump's former closest allies, Marjorie Taylor Greene, has announced that she's resigning from the House of Representatives. The one-time star of the MAGA movement had been involved in a bitter falling out with Mr. Trump, who'd called her a traitor after she criticised his earlier refusal to support the release of documents relating to the late paedophile Jeffrey Epstein. In an angry message on social media, Marjorie Taylor Greene said she had been cast aside by the president and also criticised the Trump administration for not reducing the cost of living. Talks at the COP30 climate summit in Brazil have continued through the night to try to settle a dispute over whether to mention fossil fuels in its final agreement. The meeting was due to end last night but ran into overtime, with representatives inside the negotiating room saying the talks had become very difficult. The Energy and Climate Change Secretary Ed Miliband is attending the summit.
We are determined that one way or another, we have a roadmap for the transition away from fossil fuels is kept alive at this COP. We have a big coalition of countries that is saying we've got to address this issue, this is the elephant in the room, and so we are working with those countries to find a way forward. And it's hard, because there are countries that don't want us to make progress on that, but we are going to keep fighting for it.
It's now known that gunmen in Nigeria have abducted more than 220 students and staff from a Catholic boarding school in the west of the country. Police and soldiers are searching for them in a nearby forest. It's the third such mass abduction in the country in less than a week, with kidnappers increasingly targeting students, teachers and worshippers for ransom. Rogue traders who sell illegal vapes could be fined £10,000 and face a possible prison sentence under plans expected to be announced in next week's budget. All vapes sold in the UK will also have to be labelled with digital technology, making it easier to spot fakes. More details from our business correspondent, Mark Ashdown.
After banning the sale and supply of single-use e-cigarettes in the summer, the government is now promising to crack down on illegal products sold on the black market. From next October, traders will need to have a mandatory licence, and more rigorous right-to-work checks will be introduced to try to stamp out tax evasion and exploitation. E-cigarettes will need to carry a cutting-edge digital duty stamp, including a QR code, in order to show they comply with safety and sales regulations.
And the first saplings grown from the felled Sycamore Gap tree in Northumberland are being planted today at three sites around England. They are at the Tree Sanctuary in Coventry, the site of a mining disaster in Staffordshire, and at Greenham Common in Berkshire. That's the news. Are they going to have any rain to water them? Here's Simon King.
Absolutely, Charles. Yeah, a real change in the weather through this weekend. It's not going to be as cold or as frosty as it's been, but it's going to be wetter and windier. So across England and Wales, we've got some rain this morning across southwest England, Wales, the Midlands, into parts of northern England. It's all going to move its way eastward. So after a dry and locally a bit of a frosty start in the far southeast, you'll see the rain pushing in during this afternoon. afternoon, and it's really going to linger on, I think, for parts of Lincolnshire, East Anglia, the southeast of England, down into some parts of southwest England as well throughout the afternoon. But for Cornwall, West Devon, through West Wales and across northern parts of England, there'll be some sunny spells developing. Maximum temperatures 7 to 12 degrees. For Northern Ireland, it's looking dry today. There'll be some sunny spells, highs of 7 or 8 degrees. And across Scotland, we've got some showers affecting northern and western areas. Quite cloudy, really, across Scotland this morning. Showers will continue in the west, but otherwise, though, there'll be some sunny spells developing and highs of 5 to 9 Celsius.
Simon King. We'll take a look at Saturday's newspapers now, and the proposed US deal to end the war in Ukraine is the main story for several of them. The Times says Britain and other European allies are scrambling to strengthen the plan, with concern that Ukraine would be at risk of further attacks if it weakened its armed forces. The paper suggests the UK's National Security Advisor, Jonathan Powell, could play a significant role as an intermediary between Kiev and the White House. Trump turns the screw is the main headline in the Daily Mail, which says President Zelensky faces an agonising choice between accepting what the paper calls a humiliating peace deal or losing US support. The Financial Times suggests Kiev's European allies view the proposed deal as a capitulation to Moscow's demands and says European capitals reeled at the scale of US pressure on Ukraine to agree to it. The Daily Telegraph argues in its editorial that Europe needs to tell Mr. Trump Ukraine has every right to reject the plan, which the paper calls tawdry. The Eye says that government whips are in what it calls disarray just days before the autumn budget, with the Prime Minister losing control of his MPs at a crucial time. The paper reports that multiple sources have claimed the chief whip, Jonathan Reynolds, doesn't want his job and that he's told MPs so, a suggestion Mr. Reynolds himself has denied. Back to the Daily Telegraph, which gives much of its front page to a poll which suggests the Conservatives would hold on to just 14 seats if an election were to be called now, with Reform winning a majority. The paper quotes one insider at Tory campaign headquarters as saying the party risked being consigned to the history books. The poll's reported to have been carried out by Stack Data Strategy during the summer, and allies of the Tory leader, Kemi Badenoch, say it wasn't commissioned by the party. And finally, The Sun claims that the former Duchess of York, Sarah Ferguson, is looking for a financial offer for a telltale all TV interview after the paper calls her public downfall over her links to Jeffrey Epstein. US channels are said to be willing to offer six-figure sums. A look at some of Saturday's front pages. This is BBC Radio 4 at 7 minutes past six. Now, Claire Balding's on a windy beach in Wales for this week's Ramblings.
There is a man in a black beanie hat on a sand dune up ahead of me. It's not many times you get to say that, but I've come to the Gower Peninsula to meet Rob Curtis, who spends large chunks of his time working at the Halley Research Station in Antarctica. But it would have been slightly impractical to meet him there. So we've come to a place that's a bit closer to his home base. And I'm walking up this really steep sand dune, because I think from the top of here we're going to get the most magnificent view. The wind's going to hit us as we get to the top of this mound. The white horses crashing into the bay are big and they're frisky today. Rob, oh, what a day. And the sun is beaming down on us. It's so bright.
Absolutely. It's always like this in Wales. always a sunny day in Wales. This is probably one of my favourite places. It's the sand dunes at Llangennyth. And you've got Ross City Beach just in front of you. And your very home, the tidal island, just to our right. And then on the left there, you've got the wonderful view of the Worm's Head, which is so iconic to the Gower.
To me, it doesn't actually look like a worm.
So the old English changed it to Worm's Head, but it was the Vikings that first came here and they used to shelter in there before raiding villages up and down the coast.
Because to me, that looks more like a crocodile carrying a rucksack. Do you see it's got that big lump on the back of it?
Yeah, it's absolutely beautiful. There's a lovely bridge, which is called the Devil's Bridge, and the sea runs in back and forth to it.
A man-made bridge or a natural bridge?
No, it's a natural bridge.
Of rocks.
So it's a natural bridge. Yeah. One day it'll fall down, but at the moment you can still go across there. But it's absolutely stunning. One of those magical places that you get on this planet.
Well, you're going to take me on a circular route. Head back down the sand dunes?
Yeah, straight back down the sand dunes.
I'll just give a map reference, so if people want to follow exactly where we are on OS Explorer 164, which is Gower. And actually, I'll give you the what three words for the car park, because that'll bring you right here, which is channel, dislikes, perused.
We're going straight up, Rosalie down, so I think you'll yield a lot of panting and puffing.
This is a glorious autumn day, and you can see the tops of the hills have got that pinky brown tinge to them, and the fields so rich in their greenness.
It does.
Looks like the whole thing's been painted for us.
Yeah.
What a place. So Rob, tell me a bit about you and the work that you do when you go to Antarctica and how long you go for.
Well, I'm an electrician, and I first started my service with the British Antarctic Survey in 1994. I wintered there then at Halley Base, which is the most southern Antarctic research station. And, well, it was one of the wonders of my life. When I came back from there, I thought, how do I ever top that? You know, 14 months in Antarctica, 3 months of total darkness, 3 months of total sun, conditions going down to minus 51. Ooh. And in fact, I used to pinch myself when I used to go out at night doing the weather observations. I just stood there with the stars and the galaxy opening up. It was absolutely wonderful, magical.
As we start this steep climb up to the top of Rosalie Down, the sun is almost disappearing behind our horizon, our immediate horizon. But you can still hear the sea crashing away to our right, beyond the caravan park. The odd voice of a child, it's very much end of season, so not that many people around. I think we'll get solitude up here today. Tell me more, Rob, about the Halley Research Station, what it's like there.
So if you think of Halley 6, it's a blue and a red modular system of connecting buildings. Quite unique, because it was designed to pull apart and to pull across any problems that they had, because this was Halley 6, so there'd been five stations before that. In the 90s, I was at Halley 5, because Halley 5 was on stilts, but the sea ice slowly moves towards the ocean, and it's something like 2 meters a day, so we're moving quite fast towards the ocean. And the problem I had with the stilts is that each stilt was going at a different speed, so it started twisting out of sync.
And it would pull the building apart.
So it would pull the building apart. So that was a good design, but it only lasted so many years, and then they had to build Halley 6. So the design now was to put on skis, so that each year you lift up one of the skis, then on the other side the hydraulics would pick up the other ski, and it would slowly move up above the ice, and that allows the station to actually stay there. But the problem they had was that there was a massive crack forming in the ice shelf, and they realised then that at some point it was going to carve off as an iceberg. So we had to drag the station across the other side of this crack, and we put it all back together, and it was all working again. But alas, another crack was found then, and at that point they decided to abandon it as a winter station, and now it's an automated summer station. So there's a team that's going into Antarctica probably around about this time now, at the end of October, and they'll start up the generators, they warm up the generators, and hopefully by the time I get down there, which is on the 16th of November, there'll be a nice little mint on my pillow ready for me to start work.
Is that what they leave you?
Yeah.
That's very sweet. You must have to be a master of so many different skills, because although you go there as an electrician, absolutely, you're doing everything.
Absolutely, yes. It's not just electrician. I was part of the fire search and rescue team. When we're down there, we've got no emergency services, so we got to become that emergency services. So next week I'll be doing my intense first aid training. There's been course after course.
Your skill set, though,
that we've had to learn.
It's so diverse. I mean, it's really impressive. Yeah.
Well, I got to say, probably 50% will be digging snow, because you know, one of the major things that we got to do is dig out the base, dig out the buildings, dig out the science, and that's lots and lots of shoveling loads and loads of snow. And of course, what do we drink? We can only drink the snow that we put into a melt tank. So every day we've got to try and get that snow into the melt tank. It's a Navy shower, quick wash down, soap up and then wash off. So we conserve our water because we know how hard work it is to get the water. But probably the purest water that I'll ever drink. Yeah. And the air there is absolutely pure. One of my favourite pastimes is Nordic skiing around the base. So we're allowed a 3-mile perimeter around the base in which they've checked for crevasses. And so I ski around there with my Nordic skiing. The silence sometimes when it's a still day, you can hear your heart beating, the blood pulsing through your veins. And you get to that temperature when you're skiing, and it's just right. So you're not sweating too much, but you're not cold. And that's that equilibrium there that you're just skiing around the whole of the base. And it's just amazing.
Oh, it's a good steep climb, this one. Where did you, or when did you first feel that sense of adventure, of wanting to explore further? As a child, were you quite?
Yes.
Yeah?
As a child, I used to stay off school. I used to go into the hay meadows, and I used to watch all the butterflies. And I just used to love it. And then one day, I remember watching a bird in the little woodland there, and I just thought it was a parrot or something. And it was just so colourful. And it was a bullfinch. And that bullfinch sparked my love of nature.
The steepest part of our climb is behind us. And the path has widened. And it's like a mattress underneath our feet. It's got a lovely bounce to it. And it's easy to walk through because the sheep have done the job of a lawnmower. We've got bronze-coloured bracken left and right of us. And the end of the heather. And big, chunky rocks, like teeth, left behind, marking the edge of the downs.
And you miss the anthills. The anthills are magnificent here. And that is an indicator that there's been very little pesticide or herbicide placed on this hillside. But ironically, it was one of these anthills that broke my leg when I landed paragliding. So I got a bit of a grudge against them.
So you come up here to take off, but what is paragliding also known as?
Oh, pararating, yeah. Pararating because, needless to say, you come to the top of a hill like this and the wind's too strong, or the wind's too light, or the wind's coming from the wrong direction, or the wind's too bumpy. So you spend all day waiting and then you walk all the way back down. But of course, I prefer to be a pilot, wishing I was up there, rather than a pilot up there wishing he was down here.
It's funny, as we walk, we can sometimes get shelter from the wind and it feels really still, and then you're exposed to it again and boom, it hits you. What's the wind like in Antarctica?
Well, the katabatic winds that's coming off the pole itself can be absolutely frightening. When we go out into the field and you stay in pyramid tents, so they're like the traditional tents that Scott used in the Antarctic in 1910, but they're absolutely solid, and you fix them to the ice and snow, and you fill up the edges with ice, and you go into one of them, and then when a storm hits, it's like a wild beast trying to get you outside, and the noise within the tent is deafening. Spent many an hour waking up, falling asleep, waking up, falling asleep, day after day, waiting for a storm to blow over, because you don't want to be outside in those conditions at minus 30. Any exposed skin, you get frostbite, and your flesh will start to die. So you've got to be very, very careful. Every inch is covered. We wear a mask over our face, because even when you breathe in, your teeth chill. I remember feeling the nose hairs freezing in the conditions when you go outside. Of course, you got to go outside to use the loo. So it's quite a trek to go outside and to face into the wind and do your business in just enough time without it flicking back. So there was an absolute skill to do that. But it's like being sandblasted. Some of the snow and ice conditions, absolutely horrendous. But that's what's magical about the place. Oh, look at that view there now. So, absolutely stunning. You can see the coast there running down to the Worm's Head.
And the way the sun is hitting it, I mean, it just... It feels like from the inside, the earth is shining up at us, saying, yes. Look at this. And that contrast between the rock face and the sea coming in and then the green above.
When people come down here and they think, oh, I can walk across that island, and they don't realise that the tidal shift in the Severn is so dangerous. And you know, I was looking across there, there was a chough. There was a chuff. It just flew over the edge there. We just missed it.
And what am I looking for? What does the chuff look like?
So it's black. It's got a red beak. And it makes a little chuff, chuff, chuff.
You've got your binoculars with you. Ever prepared?
Oh, I always carry my binoculars. You can see twice as many things with a pair of binoculars than you can with just the naked eye. Suddenly, there's a whole world that opens up to you that perhaps you don't realise is there. Hopefully they'll catch up with us.
Gosh, coming down, you know, it's tougher, isn't it, on the knees?
I don't think it is. I find it easier going down than it is going up. I hate going up.
Oh, I'd rather go up.
I love going down, but I got big thighs, you see, so...
Yeah, I've got big thighs too, but my knees don't like it. Hi there, morning.
Hello.
You all right? Hi. There's another family coming up. They're going to do, I think, the route we're doing, but in reverse.
Hello.
Hi there. Hello. Morning, morning.
Hi.
Hello. Last night's rain in evidence around the gateway. Thanks, Rob. We're going to take a slight diversion here, Rob. Tell me where you're heading.
So this is the church in Rossilly, St Mary's, and it's the church... where there's a memorial and a memorial window to Edgar Evans. Now, Edgar Evans was part of the Polar Party that set to the South Pole and then sadly died and perished on their return journey.
So this was with Captain Scott. He was part of with Oates and the others.
This was with Captain Scott. Yeah. So Scott decided to take five men to the pole, which was a slight mistake because the cooking facilities in these tents were meant for four men and not for five. So that became a bit of an issue, and I'm not too sure whether Captain Scott took that into consideration. But I think my frustrating thing with the whole story of Edgar Evans is he was a petty officer, wasn't an officer, and when it came down to raising the funds, he had slightly less than the other four men because he wasn't an officer.
You mean before they went or after they died?
No, after they died.
So
after they died,
his family got less than all the other families.
Absolutely, that's right.
And yet his family needed it more.
Yeah, yeah. And I feel aggrieved with that. Coming from Wales, I'm passionate about my social justice, and I just feel really angry that his family had less money, and yet he sacrificed just as much.
So he sacrificed everything.
He sacrificed everything. So there's a wonderful window as you go in here now.
Okay. Mm-hmm. Come on. It's a beautifully simple church, very little ornate decoration, just these lanterns hanging down from the rafters, white walls, and only there are two marble plates on the left wall, and one of them is in memory of Edgar Evans.
The window here is really, really nice. I think it was a girl from Swansea that actually designed the window, and it shows you two people just before a crevasse. And Edgar Evans fell down a crevasse, and they think the fall there caused a brain hemorrhage that slowly got worse and worse, and that's why he collapsed and died. And I quite like this memorial. This one here. Remember, man, as you pass by, as you are now, so once was I. As I am now, so you shall be. Prepare in time to follow me. That's wow.
Leaving the church and the churchyard behind us, there's a man sitting on a bench waiting for a bus right ahead of us. And we are making our way down to the beach. Morning.
Hello.
come down the path from St Mary's, the church up at Rossilli, onto the beach. And this Rossilli Bay beach is 3 miles long. Absolute flat, beautiful sand. There are dogs, there are children, there are adults. There's a big rock sticking out of the sand at an angle. What is it?
No, it's a wreck. It's a wreck. So it's the Helvetia, and it was a ship, a Norwegian ship that was carrying timber. And when that got wrecked, Edgar Evans would have been about 11 years of age. So he would have seen this, and they were picking up all the bits and pieces of timber that got washed up. But ironically, when I'm paragliding, I remember my instructor saying, OK, you've got a 3 mile long beach here, but for some reason, when you look at that ship, you'll start heading towards that ship. And as you could land on the beach, because it's a big, empty, wide space. So when I was paragliding, I think to myself, right, I've got to avoid the wreck. I must avoid the wreck. And yet each time I get closer and closer and closer to the wreck. And it was a real effort to try and avoid landing on the wreck. So that's what it is.
We've also got with us, and you've handed me a litter picker, which is one of those great devices where you can scoop up anything. You've got a bag, because if we see any rubbish, we shall. Yes. You've got it already, bits of plastic.
Anything like that.
Yep.
For 15 years now, I've helped organise myself, Claire, my wife, and Verity, organise Friends of Barry Beaches, and we collect whatever litter that we can. It's something that's damaging the environment. In the Antarctic, there was a place I was working at, Sydney, and I found a Coca-Cola bottle, and that broke my heart, because it's in the midst of nowhere and it shouldn't be there.
You mentioned your wife, you do litter picking with her. How is she with your disappearing off for long chunks of time?
She tolerates it. There'll be a tear or two when I go onto the bus station at Cardiff, ready to go south. But she knows that I've always wanted to discover different places. But I think she's a bit nervous now, because I'm 61, and suddenly electrician is 61. I've got to give up my job for this. The last time I went, my company gave me the time off, but I think this is a trip too far now. So they've said, you're leaving us at the worst of winter when we need electrician on site. I can understand it, but you've got to make that decision then to either go and follow your adventures. And in reality, I'm probably on the last quarter of my working life.
Surely when you come back, there is always huge demand for people with your skills. Well, I say people with your skills, very few people have the combination of skills that you have.
True, very true. And the training that I've gone through puts me in a better position. But in reality, I'm 61 years of age and I got diabetes. So suddenly the job selection gets a bit tighter.
Looking out to sea, and there are 1, 2, 3 brightly coloured sails up above, kite surfers who are riding the waves. The wind is so strong. Look at that one taking off over there. Do you see it? Yeah. Flying up through the air. Oh my word, he's gone up high. That's a proper leap. That is a thrill. You see, your wife might say to you, look, Rob, there are things closer to home that would satisfy that need, desire for adventure.
Yeah, she probably does say that. But you know what? You can't replace an emperor penguin. Can't replace the whales or the wildlife that I got the potential of seeing. And the extremes of temperature, the extremes that I'm going out to. And contributing to that quality science that they carry out. And that's so important to me. And your hat's gone.
Hat flew off in the wind.
Yeah.
Oh no, I totally get it.
Yeah.
But also, you've had to work really hard this time because you had to try and combat your diabetes. How did you change your diet?
It means that I got to try to avoid the sugary bits and pieces. And that's hard for me because being 61, I've had a lifetime of addiction to sugars. Of course, what I've got is that prize at the end now, which I didn't have before, of going south to Antarctica. So I've been in the gym constantly, I've been walking continuously, And there's no easy fix to it. Luckily, I've managed to keep it under control, and the British Antarctic Survey have said go.
We've reached the last turn. We're going to head right back up the sand dune where we first met. You're going to take that bag of rubbish home with you, Rob.
Yeah.
And the water is behind us now. And I'm going to leave Rossilli feeling uplifted, invigorated. Oh my gosh, just energised by the wind. And by your stories, Rob. I mean, good luck on your next voyage to Antarctica.
Oh, thank you very much. Yeah. Can I test your knowledge now?
Go on.
So, there's a famous explorer that said, to get to where I'm going, I've got to walk away from where I've been. Which great explorer said that?
I'm going to guess and say Edgar Evans.
Nope.
Captain Scott.
Nope.
Oates.
Nope.
Amundsen.
Nope. Winnie the Pooh. He was. Oh. He was a great explorer. So for every child that heard that quote, it probably inspires them. And I'm hoping that my story will inspire people that perhaps got a medical condition, that they can control that medical condition and carry on with their dreams. And don't let diabetes hold you back.
Well, you have helped end this series of ramblings in a triumphant style. So thank you very much. And enjoy heading south.
Diolch yn fawr.
Ramblings with Claire Balding is produced by Karen Gregor, and it's a BBC Studios production for BBC Radio 4. Where, in just a moment, Farming Today this week reports that wool prices have reached a 9-year high, but that still doesn't cover the cost of shearing the sheep. We'll also be meeting the inmates who look after pigs at a prison farm in Kent. And a decline in demand for whiskey is being blamed for the closure and suspension of Scottish malting plants. Farmers fear it may also mean a decline in demand for barley. That's next. And then at 7 o'clock, it's the Today programme presented this morning by Anna Foster and Simon Jack. And they, no doubt, will have the latest on this.
This winter, cricket's oldest rivalry is reignited.
Bowl him! Bowl him first ball!
England and Australia do battle to compete for the Ashes.
That is extraordinary!
Hear live ball-by-ball commentary on Five Sports Extra and get analysis and reaction of every day's play with the Test Match Special podcast.
The stump's out of the ground!
Test Match Special at the Ashes. Listen on BBC Sounds.
This is BBC Radio 4. It's a little after 6:30, time now for Farming Today This Week with Charlotte Smith.
Good morning. This week, England's biggest agri-environment scheme will be relaunched next year.
It's our most popular scheme with 39,000 live agreements, and it's top of my inbox to get the offer right for you.
And wool prices reach a 9-year high, but
the first goal is to get to that covering the shearing cost for the farmers, and it's been a difficult task. But as an organisation, we're acutely aware that it's not where it needs to be.
More on all that later. Let's start, though, with a different sort of farm. It's in a prison. The prison service used to run a network of farms producing food for and offering work to the inmates. Just a handful remain, including at the women's prison, East Sutton Park in Kent. Its farm has pigs, cattle and sheep, and prisoners supply the prison kitchens with the food they produce, as well as learning skills that help them find work when they leave jail. Well, I went to the Category D prison, that's an open prison, and met two of the prisoners. Well, just outside the piggery actually are some of the women who work here on the farm. We're not going to use their real names, so let's call them Alice and Lisa. Alice, just tell me why you are working here on the farm.
So when I arrived here, it was my first port of call. I come from the countryside. To me, farming is something really special to the country, and I know many farmers, so to come here and to be involved myself was a privilege. I just found it to be just a brilliant escape from everything, not only within the prison, but in anything I've ever known. The chance to work outside with animals is just fabulous.
Even though you grew up in the countryside, did it ever occur to you before coming here that farming was something you wanted to try?
So I come from a horsey family. So farming and horses, they work alongside, but not quite together. So it's always been something I'd love to have given a go. So I'm happy to be doing it.
And what do you do on an average day on the farm?
We sort the pigs out, we feed them, we muck them out, make sure they're comfortable, they're happy, they're healthy. Maintenance, tidying, fixing, anything at all.
It's sort of endless, isn't it, when you start on a farm?
It is. It completely is. There is always work on a farm. There are always leaves falling off trees, always pigs escaping, just always something. An endless but wonderful job.
Do lots of people want to work on the farm? Or is it just a select few of people who are tempted?
So there is a waiting list to work on the farm. This is a sought-after job. It's very trying. You get covered in, obviously, every kind of matter that a farm brings with it. But it is desired here, definitely. It comes with so many things that people have never seen, and it can teach people and let them into a world that they would not usually have the opportunity to enter. So, yes, I feel privileged to work here because everyone wants to work on the farm.
Also with us is another of the people who volunteers to work here on the farm, who we're going to call Lisa. As we're talking, one of the pigs has come out to say hello. Who's
this? Petunia.
You're kidding me.
Petunia.
She's lovely. She's honestly one of beautiful. The most friendly pigs.
Alice is just leaning over and scratching her ears. And she's... You're very happy, aren't you? Petunia? Where did
Petunia.
That come from?
A lot of them are named after the officers, I believe.
I think we'll just leave that there, shall we? Susan Anderson's in charge of education and training here at the prison. Some people are going to listen to this and they're going to think these women are actually having quite a nice time and they're supposed to be in prison. Is that a fair criticism?
No, they're here for rehabilitation. So they are here to learn new skills. They're here to learn how to turn up to work on time, to get used to getting out of bed and doing a day's worth of work and getting them ready for the real world. So, you know, and I think one of the hardest jobs is working on the farm, working out, especially in the winter. It's beautiful today, an autumn day, but in the winter, this is a cold, frosty, wet environment to be in. So it's certainly not an easy place to be. But the skills they learn, you know, the tractor driving, that can be took on to other warehouse jobs and things. They're all transferable. The teamwork when they're doing the CVs and when they're doing the interviews, they've got experiences to talk about. That, again, helps them to get the job on release, which is what we want to do. We want to rehabilitate them so they don't come back to prisons again.
And you can hear more from East Sutton Park Prison on Your Farm tomorrow morning at 6:30 here on Radio 4, or after that anytime on BBC Sounds. Now, the price farmers get for wool is up, about 20% up from last year, but it still doesn't cover the cost of shearing the sheep. As we've reported on this programme over the years, the fall in demand for carpets and woolly jumpers hit wool prices. But British Wool, which buys and markets the wool, hopes that now, with prices at a nine-year high, they've turned a corner. Graham Clark from British Wool told me that fewer sheep in the world means higher prices.
From a supply point of view, there is less wool on the market. If you look at Australia, a lot of that's down to climate change. They've had some really adverse climate change effects, so that's droughts and floods, meaning the loss of a lot of livestock. So a lot of farmers have moved out of sheep because of that. In New Zealand, they've had a campaign to plant more trees for carbon capture. Subsequently, their sheep numbers have fallen quite dramatically. And in the UK, one of the reasons is subsidies. Subsidies changing from per head to more of an environmental land management system. So probably different reasons for each individual country, which is quite interesting.
So the price has gone up, but there is a big but in all this, isn't there?
Yes, there's always a big but. It's not where it needs to be. So it's much improved. So the past two or three months, we've had some really good increase in the wool price. But as an organisation, we're acutely aware that it's not where it needs to be. The first goal is to get to that covering the shearing cost for the farmers.
Which is kind of basic, isn't it?
It is, and it's been really difficult since COVID. So, and it's been a difficult task to get the price to somewhere near covering shearing costs. Where it stands at the moment, certain types of wool that farms have would cover the shearing cost. So hopefully it'll continue in this positive vein and we'll be able to give farmers a much more meaningful return for the wool than we've been able to do over the past few years.
I'm sure people listening to this will be thinking, well, a wool carpet and a wool jumper, they're not cheap items. So where is the money going in this chain?
Wool needs a lot of processing. So when wool leaves the farm, it needs to be cleaned as a first stage. Then it needs to be made into yarns and then carpets, and it gets retailed. So it's a massively long supply chain. Our job is to get as much value as possible for the farmers. And we try and do that through working with our licensee partners. So we work with 173 brands across the world, a high proportion of those are in the UK. But we do have partners in China, Japan, Korea, and also the US as well. And we're introducing schemes such as our traceable wool scheme, which is helping deliver more money back to our farmer members as well. And we charge a premium over our auction price for that. And that's starting to yield some really positive results.
Graham Clark from British Wool. A decline in demand for whisky is being blamed for the closure and suspension of Scottish malting plants, something which farmers fear will also mean a decline in demand for barley. Maltsters process barley so it can be used in distilleries or brewing. Diageo has announced that its plant near Elgin will be closed until at least July next year, and another company, Baird, says it will close one of its plants. Well, NFU Scotland described the situation as concerning, particularly as it comes after a tough year when the weather affected both the yield and quality of barley crops. Dr. Julian South, Executive Director of the Maltsters Association of Great Britain, which represents maltsters.
I don't think this is a long-term worry. It's a short-term correction at the moment in time. Distillers have been gearing up with producing lots of spirit in the last couple of years, and some warehouses are pretty full of spirit. The long-term trend within distilling is growth, and you do see ups and downs in the distilling market, because when you make whiskey, you put it in a warehouse and you store it for up to 10 years or more. So it's quite a long process, but quite different from the brewing industry.
Although these companies are saying there's a decline in demand for whisky, which is why they're doing this.
Well, there are challenges ahead. I mean, things like the US tariffs have created problems. Ukraine war, so there are no longer exports to Russia. So there is turbulence in the market. And of course, we know that as well, that there's an economic sort of challenge in the UK.
Farmers are surely right to be worried, because fewer plants will mean less demand, won't it?
So we've lost a bit of malting capacity. But if you look at the growth in the last few years, something like 124,000 tonnes of extra capacity has been added to existing malting plants. So that's actually an increase in capacity.
What percentage of the barley that is malted by your members is grown here in the UK?
Over 99%. Only a very small quantity comes from overseas, and that's usually varieties which we don't actually grow in the UK.
This year has been difficult because of the weather, which has had a knock-on effect. Has that made things harder for maltsters?
It has. I mean, maltsters have had to deal with a lot of crop which has not been within specifications. And in addition, there have been sort of high nitrogen barleys as well. But overall, there's been a reasonably sufficient 2025 crop.
What do they do with the stuff that doesn't make it?
So In a typical year, we might screen out 5% or slightly more of small grains. But in this year, we've had to screen out up to 20%. That material is pelleted along with other maltings, co-products to produce and goes into the animal feed stream.
So if you're a farmer in Scotland, then it's still worth planting barley this year for you?
Absolutely. It's really a case of glass half full, glass half empty. I mean, if you look at the quantity that will be required for next year, so yes, it will be less, but there's still a substantial quantity of barley.
Dr. Julian South. COP30 has been held in Brazil over the past couple of weeks and included 2 days of discussion about agriculture. On our sister programme, Farming Today, we took this opportunity to hear stories of farming and fishing from around the globe, to find out about the challenges faced by food producers in different parts of the world and the solutions they're working on to build resilience. Farming fish, aquaculture rather than livestock, is seen by some as the answer to sustainable food security. China is one of the world's biggest farmed seafood producers, providing more than 60% of the world's farmed fish, and it's investing in bigger and more high-tech fish farms. Jonah van Beinen is a biologist and fish farmer working primarily in Asia and the Middle East.
China sees that in order to A secure future needs for food locally. It needs to produce more seafood. Mostly this is because production on land is already fully utilized. So there's not much room to produce more livestock and more crops on land. So instead it has turned to the sea.
And what sorts of fish farms is that leading to?
So in the coastal zone, you got typical fish ponds. It can be cages in the sea. And lately, China has been working on a lot of innovative designs, including sunken structures that are anchored to the sea bottom or floating large ships.
Are there any concerns in China about the welfare of the fish in these systems?
Typically in Asia, and including China, there's much less focus on fish welfare. But of course, if one wants to run its farm profitable, you have to make sure that the fish are doing well and survive. High stocking densities tend to result in more pollution. And as in the past, the Chinese coastal zone and freshwater resources have been quite extensively polluted. They now enforce strict regulations on water quality. So this has an effect on the farms that they tend to use lower stocking densities. And many farms have been moving from open farming systems, where you typically put the wastewater back in public waters, to closed systems in which the water is recirculated.
How sustainable is this? What, for instance, are they feeding all these fish on?
So typically fish meal is used for this. But since there's been a lot of public attention on changing this, now more and more wastes, byproducts from processing are being used. And the industry has been looking for alternatives. So, for example, quite a few companies have popped up that use insects to develop insect meal instead of fish meal. Other companies have started to work with bacteria that convert methane into protein. So this is quite an active segment, and it's definitely moving in the right direction.
When we're thinking about mitigating climate change, how does aquaculture fit into that?
It does play an important role because we, of course, need to feed the people on planet Earth. And aquaculture has proven to be the most efficient ways of producing animal protein, especially compared to species like cows, chickens, pigs.
Although, as we've seen here, where we have lots of fish farms, particularly in Scotland, they are controversial because, campaigners say, they have a big impact on the local environment.
Yes, you are correct. Everywhere, I think, there are good and bad farms. And it's a matter of governments that need to step in and to make sure that farms stick to the rules.
Jonah van Beinen, well, more on climate and farming on BBC Sounds. Just search for Farming Today. And just to say, you can set your smart speaker to play Radio 4 and wake up with us every morning at 5:45. There's something to look forward to. Now, remember this.
We're on Whitehall, and as I look down Whitehall, it's just a sea of green and countryside hues, isn't it? It's
as far
weird.
As you can see, yeah.
Farmers just don't know what to do. They're desperate. They needed this. They need that outlet. We have huge amounts often, like, tied up in the assets needed to farm. We can't pay tax from them without selling them. And that's why most of these farms are going to end up and be sold to pay these tax bills.
This week marks a year since thousands of farmers gathered in London protesting at the government's decision in last autumn's budget to impose 20% inheritance tax on farm assets of more than £1 million. Since then, the arguments and counter-arguments have raged. Farmers say the tax is unfair and will put some out of business. The government says it is fair, half of the usual inheritance tax rate, and that the majority of farmers won't be affected. The two sides have met, but as we heard from the Farming Minister, Mr. Angela Eagle last month, and indeed we'll hear again later in the programme today, there are no plans to change the inheritance tax rules in this year's budget next week. Farmers, though, are continuing to campaign. More demonstrations are planned, and this week there was a mass lobby of Parliament. One of the organisers, farmer Ollie Harrison, spoke to us as he was making his way from Merseyside to London.
we've got the public on side. You know, in the last 12 months, we might have the politicians been a little bit stubborn, but we've educated the public as to how damaging the policy of IHT can be to farms and other businesses. And it's important that we keep talking about it so that we do get that change. You know, if we can get the public to understand what's going on exactly, then the MPs have got to listen to them in their own constituencies. And then that means that they've got to then come up with policy that fits better, because at the moment it's awful. The policy is just not right. You know, it's affecting family businesses, affecting family farms, it's putting up the cost of food production. They need to realise that unless they change tact very quickly, they're going to completely lose the rural vote and any family business vote. And they need to look at that seriously and get some trust back within the constituents.
Ollie Harrison. Well, IHT was mentioned at the Country Land and Business Association conference this week, but not by the Environment Secretary, Emma Reynolds, who spoke at the event. She did, though, say that details on the relaunch of England's biggest agri-environment scheme will come in the first half of next year. As you may remember, this scheme, the Sustainable Farming Incentive, or SFI, pays farmers for things like planting hedges and improving soils. It was suddenly closed to new applicants in March as it had run out of money. Well, Emma Reynolds told the conference that the issue is complicated and they want to get it right.
It's our most popular scheme with 39,000 live agreements, and it's top of my inbox to get the offer right for you. It's urgent, but it's also complex. And it must work for the years to come. Over the course of this year, the team have worked closely with the CLA and other stakeholders to consider improvements which build on what has been working well in SFI, and also, obviously, to address what hasn't worked so well. I'm now considering how to change the scheme so that it better supports sustainable farming and drives growth. The changes we are considering will be an evolution, not a revolution, because I know that you need that stability.
Emma Reynolds, the Environment Secretary. Just before she spoke, England's farm business income figures for the last financial year, 2024-25, were released. All types of farms, with the exception of horticulture and pig farming, saw a year-on-year increase. Though, to put that in context, remember that in 2023-24, farm incomes dropped considerably. The government payments to farmers in agri-environment schemes now make up an average of 30% of farm income, and many farms continue to lose money on the farming sides of their businesses. Well, Ms. Reynolds said that making farming pay remained a priority, and that the government will publish and respond to the profitability review led by the former NFU president Minette Batters soon. The new CLA president, Gavin Lane, welcomed her comments but told me farming needs less change.
I think there was a recognition of some of the issues that, and challenges that our members face. There was a recognition of the need for some stability, which we haven't seen for a while, and the need to try and focus in on that stability to drive growth and investment for the countryside.
Although there were a lot of things that you talked about in your speech which opened this conference, which were not mentioned in hers. Things like, for instance, inheritance tax.
I couldn't imagine that she was going to say anything about inheritance tax. Ultimately, that's a Treasury decision, and we know from the rural Labour MPs that we've spoken to that there isn't any movement there. We can't see any movement there. So was it worth mentioning? Probably not, really, in that context. I really want to stay on the positives because we really need some of that happening very, very soon.
We have had some positive news on farm incomes, which are generally up, although that has revealed a big reliance on agri-environment schemes. The Secretary of State talked about the relaunch of SFI in the first half of next year. What did you make of that? Because we were expecting details on that in the summer.
Yeah, it's not great. I think where we're at is actually this harvest, which obviously wouldn't have been in the figures, is particularly bad. I know in the east the yields are appalling. We've seen record prices for feed and for straw. It is proving really, really difficult as people go into the winter. And obviously with the removal of BPS or down to very, very small amounts, it's really, really vital that those people that didn't get into SFI get into SFI as quickly as possible, especially if they haven't been in a countryside stewardship scheme.
You've just taken over as president of the CLA. Do you feel that you're taking over at a tricky time?
Yes. I don't think any of us envisaged this. I mean, the change in politics in the last 5 years, let alone, you know, the last 6 months, there's been so much movement and so much, I mean, I'm not going to say chaos, but it feels very, very difficult to plan in such a tricky political climate. But hopefully we get some stability.
CLA President Gavin Lane. The Environment Secretary didn't want to talk to us or any other media after her speech, but along with a select few from the farming press, I was invited to DEFRA to speak to the Farming Minister, Angela Eagle. She was asked how the government can rebuild trust with the farming sector.
Well, I mean, we need to create a direction of travel for farming, and we've also got to talk about stability and clarity, which is what the Secretary of State was talking about earlier at the conference. But we're also talking about partnership working and how we can make farming profitable and sustainable. The Secretary of State talked about the Batters Review, which will be published before Christmas. We've in the middle of doing a farming pathway, which is a 25-year strategy of directions. We've also got the land use framework. It all goes together to form a kind of whole. And so we'll be announcing most of those things in the early parts of next year. So hopefully we can begin to build a plan.
Farming income figures out today reveal that agri-environment figures on average make up 30% of farm incomes. They're really important. Yeah. We were expecting details on the new SFI in the summer. It's now November. The Secretary of State says in the first half of next year. This is getting silly.
Well, I think we need to get it right. And we've had the reshuffle, so that means you've got to have a look from scratch at what's going on. So we know how important this is. But I'm taking a little bit of time so that I can have a look at a range of issues, see what's worked well, see what hasn't, see how we can make best use of the money. There will be clarity and certainty in time for the schemes to be opened. There's also a delivery issue with the tech that we have as well. So it's a question of getting that sequence right so that we can move forward with the next iteration of SFI in a way that I hope will be more transparent and sustainable.
You've got all these things that you're talking about. The one thing you're not talking about, of course, is the elephant in the room, which is inheritance tax. I was with a group of farmers last week who were really up, they say, for growth. But they will say at the moment they're not spending money investing in their businesses. They don't want to make them worth any more money. Or they're paying out lots of money for professional advice on how to manage succession. What would you say to them?
I mean, the inheritance tax announcements were made in the budget last year, and I know how much angst that has generated in the farming community. I think we have to look forwards. I was very clear about what the situation was when I was asked on your programme a few weeks ago. And what we've got to do is look at what we can do on sustainability and profitability to build farming markets, potential for export abroad, a range of things on developments on agritech, what we can do to make the whole approach work together more. And I understand what people's views about IHT are, but we are where we are on that one and we've got to look forward.
The Farming Minister, Angela Eagle. And that's it from us. I'm Charlotte Smith. The producer is Beatrice Fenton, and Farming Today this week is a BBC Audio Bristol production.
That brings the time to 3 minutes to seven. Time for a look at the weather forecast with Simon King.
Charles, thank you so much indeed. Good morning. Yeah, a very different feel to the weather for the weekend compared to the last few days. We've cut off that northerly flow, the Arctic air, and it's going to be much milder. But the milder weather comes with some wetter weather. So this morning in southwest England and Wales, we've got some rain at the moment. That rain is going to mostly clear away to the east. It'll take a little while to clear from parts of south Wales and southwest England, but there will be some sunshine developing eventually across parts of Cornwall, West Devon, through western areas of Wales through this afternoon, and maximum temperatures getting up to about 7 to 12 degrees. For the Midlands, eastern and southeast England, we had a bit of a frost this morning across some eastern areas, but generally speaking, the cloud has been moving in. We've got some rain that's pushing through the Midlands, pushing now into parts of eastern England as well. So that rain is going to linger on into the afternoon. It's going to be a thoroughly wet afternoon, actually, for parts of East Anglia and the southeast. That rain could be quite heavy in places. Maximum temperature is only 7 to 9 Celsius. Now, for northern England, a bit of rain to start off this morning around southern areas, but the rain is going to clear away and it's going to leave a largely dry afternoon. There'll be some sunny spells, especially across some northern areas, highs of 8 to 10 Celsius. For Northern Ireland, it's a dry day with some sunny spells, highs of 7 or 8 degrees. And for Scotland, quite cloudy this morning, some showers in the north and the west. Those showers will continue through the afternoon, but elsewhere, some sunny spells developing quite widely, temperatures of 5 to 9 degrees. Now, through tonight, rain will eventually clear from eastern and southeastern areas. Lots of cloud, but then further rain which will be quite heavy, moves into Northern Ireland, southwest Scotland and Wales. Temperatures overnight 2 to 6 degrees. During Sunday, there is a bit of uncertainty with the forecast, but rain is expected to move its way eastward. It will still be heavy at times. Some sunny spells developing, but showers for Northern Ireland, southern Scotland and northern England.
And that was Simon King. This is BBC Radio 4 in just a moment. Anna Foster and Simon Jack will be here with the Today programme.
BBC Scam Safe Week on Radio 4.
A week of programmes helping you stay informed in the fight against fraud. You and Yours investigates how criminals are using the latest technology to scam you as they stand right in front of you.
There's drama about the ruthless world of call centres in Scammer.
Mum, who did you lend this money to?
And The Food Programme follows a story involving fake identities, the Scottish Highlands and some fraudulent tea.
BBC Scam Safe Week.
Across this week on Radio 4 and BBC Sounds.
On FM, on digital and on BBC Sounds, this is BBC Radio 4.
Good morning, it's 7 o'clock on Saturday the 22nd of November. This is Today with Simon Jack in London and Anna Foster in Salford.
The headlines this morning, Sir Keir Starmer says European allies will discuss how to react to President Trump's plan to end the war in Ukraine when they meet at the G20 summit. The COP30 climate talks in Brazil have gone into overtime because of a bitter dispute over whether to mention fossil fuels in the final text. And new measures are being planned to crack down on rogue traders selling illegal vapes.
Also on today's programme, one of President Trump's closest allies, the Congresswoman Marjorie Taylor Greene, says she's resigning after their spectacular falling out, and she's placed the blame at the feet of the president.
Standing up for American women who were raped, trafficked and used by rich, powerful men should not result in me being called a traitor and threatened by the president of the United States, whom I fought for.
We will ask what impact her resignation might have on MAGA voters in America. We'll look at the efforts to gather more evidence on the long-term impact of puberty blockers on children as a new clinical trial starts. We'll speak to the lead researcher of a new study into the effects. And can you believe it is 30 years since Toy Story first hit the big screen? So with a fifth film now on the way, the writer Frank Cottrell Boyce reflects on why we still love it so much.
I'm Carthy, Niana Segrin with your Saturday sport, and an extraordinary first day of the Ashes has moved into an excellent day two for Australia. With Mitchell Starc bowling Joe Root, dismissing Ben Stokes, England have just collapsed to 164 all out. Australia now need 205 runs to win.
Before all of that, the BBC News is read for us this morning by Charles Carroll.
The Prime Minister is due to meet key European allies of Ukraine at the G20 summit in South Africa to work out a response to the US-drafted plan to end the war with Russia. Last night, Donald Trump insisted President Zelensky needed to accept the deal, which appears to be tipped heavily in Moscow's favour. Sir Keir Starmer said the talks on the margins of the summit would look at creating the space for what he called meaningful peace negotiations. Our political editor, Chris Mason, is travelling with the Prime Minister and has sent this report from Johannesburg.
This is a summit President Trump has declined to attend, and yet his actions are shaping its most salient discussions. Ukraine's allies here are scrambling to react to the White House's plan, keen to appear constructive in public, while some are clearly horrified in private. In support of President Trump's push for peace, the Prime Minister said, his discussions with other leaders here would look at how we can strengthen this plan. The widely leaked US draft includes proposals that Kyiv had previously ruled out, ceding eastern areas it now controls, significantly cutting the size of its army, and pledging not to join NATO. President Trump has set a deadline of Thursday for President Zelensky to agree. At the White House last night, he put more pressure on the Ukrainian leader.
At some point, he's going to have to accept something. You know, he hasn't accepted. You remember right in the Oval Office not so long ago, I said, you don't have the cards.
President Zelensky has said Ukraine faces one of the most difficult moments in its history. His country, he said, might face a very difficult choice, either losing dignity or risk losing a key partner in America.
Talks at the COP30 climate summit in Brazil have continued through the night to try to settle a dispute over whether to mention fossil fuels in the final agreement. The meeting was due to end last night but ran into overtime, with representatives inside the negotiating room saying the talks had become very difficult. Our climate editor, Justin Rolat, reports from the summit in Belém.
These talks have ground to a standstill over a question that is likely to seem absurd to most people. Given fossil fuels are the main driver of climate change, surely it shouldn't be controversial to mention them in the final text of the world's main climate summit, not least because the need to phase them out was agreed at a COP 2 years ago. But a group made up of fossil fuel producing countries and their allies, including Saudi Arabia, is understood to have been refusing even to discuss the words being mentioned. Meanwhile, countries led by the European Union and including the UK is equally adamant they should be included. If a compromise can't be found, there is a risk the conference could fail and call into question the entire COP process itself.
One of President Trump's closest allies, Marjorie Taylor Greene, has announced that she's resigning from the House of Representatives. In an angry message on social media, the former star of the MAGA movement said that she had been cast aside by the president and refused to be treated like a battered wife. In his first response, the president said her resignation was good news for the country. From Washington, here's our North America correspondent, Sean Dilley.
Marjorie Taylor Greene appeared disappointed and hurt in a lengthy video statement posted on social media. Once a leading light in the MAGA movement and perhaps the president's loudest advocate, she claimed to have spent millions of her own dollars supporting Donald Trump when others had stabbed him in the back. But she added loyalty should be a two-way street. The pair had been involved in a bitter falling out earlier this month over Mr. Trump's initial refusal to support the release of documents relating to the late sex offender Jeffrey Epstein. In her resignation video, which lasted more than 10 minutes, Marjorie Taylor Greene didn't mention Epstein by name, but she said she felt cast aside and shouldn't have been called a traitor by the president. She also focused on the cost of living and foreign policy.
It's now known that gunmen in Nigeria have abducted more than 220 students and staff from a Catholic boarding school in the west of the country. Police and soldiers are searching for them in a nearby forest. It's the third such mass abduction in the country in less than a week, with kidnappers increasingly targeting students, teachers and worshippers for ransom. Researchers at King's College London have given details of a clinical trial to assess the risks and benefits of puberty-blocking drugs for children and young people who are questioning their gender. The first patients are to be recruited in the new year, as our health correspondent Dominic Hughes reports.
The team behind this trial say there are strongly held and polarised views about the risk of drugs which delay the onset of puberty for young people unhappy with or questioning their gender. Their use was banned in the UK outside of clinical trials following a review by Dr. Hilary Cass last year that found there was insufficient evidence to say they were safe and which called for more research. This new clinical trial, one of a number of studies, will involve around 220 children who are currently accessing gender services. They will have all reached puberty but will be younger than 16 and will have to meet strict criteria and undergo intensive medical and psychological screening before they're allowed to access puberty blockers. They'll have ongoing support while the trial will look at issues such as bone density, brain development and mental health and well-being. The first results should be available in around 4 years. But the contentious nature of any work in this area is clear. There have already been calls for the trial to be halted on the grounds that it's unlawful and unethical.
Rogue traders who sell illegal vapes could be fined £10,000 and face a possible prison sentence under plans expected to be announced in next week's budget. All vapes sold in the UK will also have to be labelled with digital technology, making it easier to spot fakes. More details from our business correspondent, Mark Ashdown.
It's thought that 1 in 10 adults in Britain vapes. After banning the sale and supply of single-use e-cigarettes in the summer, the government is now promising to crack down on illegal products sold on the black market. From next October, traders will need to have a mandatory licence and more rigorous right-to-work checks will be introduced to try to stamp out tax evasion and exploitation. E-cigarettes will need to carry a cutting-edge digital duty stamp, including a QR code, in order to show they comply with safety and sales regulations. Legitimate businesses will be able to register for the new scheme from April next year before it becomes compulsory in the autumn. They will also have 6 months to sell any unstamped stock.
In the cricket, another extraordinary passage of play in the first Ashes test in Australia has seen England lose 4 wickets in 12 minutes. They slumped to 76 for 5 after lunch in Perth, before then losing the man who could have steadied the ship, their captain Ben Stokes, at the hands of the Australian bowler Mitchell Starc.
Starc again bowls, and it's edge and caught. Stokes is out. And a massive wicket.
Rearguard batting action by England's bowlers helped the visitors mount something of a recovery, and a few moments ago England were all out for 164. The first saplings grown from the felled Sycamore Gap tree in Northumberland are to be planted today. The famous tree stood by Hadrian's Wall for more than 100 years before it was illegally chopped down in September of 2023. The saplings have been grown from the seeds and material rescued from the tree. The first three will be planted today at the Tree Sanctuary in Coventry, the site of a mining disaster in Staffordshire, and at Greenham Common in Berkshire.
Charles, thank you very much indeed. It's just coming round to 7:10. Let's turn our attention, first of all, this morning to the situation in Ukraine, because the country's allies are going to hold talks on the sidelines of the G20 summit later about the US plan to end the war, which has been, you will no doubt have seen, criticised as heavily weighted in favour of Russia's demands. President Zelensky has been diplomatic in his response so far, but he has been very frank about Ukraine's increasingly limited options.
Now, the pressure on Ukraine is one of the most difficult. Now, Ukraine may find itself facing a very difficult choice, either the loss of dignity or the risk of losing a key partner.
Well, our correspondent Joe Inwood is following developments. Morning, Joe.
Good morning, Anna.
President Zelensky is right in many ways. He has European support, although they haven't been particularly vocal about the shortcomings in this plan. Can they afford to lose the US as a key ally?
That is obviously one of the key things that they are trying to avoid. And it's amazing. It's interesting how diplomatic they've been in reacting to a plan which crosses pretty much every red line that the Ukrainians and the European allies have had. The suggestion that this territory would be given up is something that they have said they will never do. And now this key ally, the United States, is saying that that is essentially what they might have to do. Of course, the US has dialed back the amount of funding they're giving to Ukraine, but they are still one of the main sources of weapons, paid for but now by the Europeans to a large extent. And you can see from all of the words that have come out from Keir Starmer, from Volodymyr Zelensky, that they are trying to do everything they can not to alienate the Americans. But it's going to be a very, very difficult conversation for the Europeans on the sidelines of the G20. One thing that I noticed when looking through this plan is that the thing that we've spoken about so many times, this coalition of the willing, the plan by the British and the French to put boots on the ground or to have some sort of reassurance force, is explicitly ruled out. So it seems that what the Americans have done is put forward a plan without discussing it with the Europeans that explicitly rules out one of the main policy areas that the Europeans have been working on. So, as you say, lots of difficult conversations to be had.
Yeah, because linked into that, there's an undertaking that Ukraine would not join NATO. There is no real guarantee, even though it talks about Russia not attacking again. There's no solidity in that guarantee. So that is why people are saying that it really is very, very heavily weighted in favour of what Russia would want rather than what Ukraine would want.
Yeah, and we should say, of course, this is just a leaked draft, but it has been leaked to three reputable news organisations. And the wording on point three is the one that's really extraordinary. It says, it is expected that Russia will not invade neighbouring countries and NATO will not expand further. So putting aside the sort of moral equivalence of putting those two things, invading or expanding an alliance side by side, the idea that the wording that's used is it's expected that Russia will not, rather than there being some sort of fulsome demand, it just seems very odd wording that many people have pointed out. And I think the point that the Ukrainians have made and will continue to make is that they need really, really robust security guarantees. And for them, one of the main forms that that would take is the ability to defend themselves. And so the weak wording in this, combined with the fact that there would be a reduction in their armed forces, and of course the point that President Zelensky makes, that they have been invaded before, the word has been gone back on before, I think all of that combines to make this wording as we see it, and the general principles of this document, one that would make the Europeans and, of course, the Ukrainians primarily incredibly uneasy.
Thank you, Joe. We will speak in about an hour's time to a former US special representative for Ukraine. He actually worked under President Trump in his first term, on what this means, not just for Ukraine, but for its allies, for Europe as well. And we'll also get a sense of public opinion in Ukraine as well. As President Zelensky was saying, there are difficult choices ahead. So we will assess what people in the country think about those as well.
It is 14 minutes past seven. More trouble at the top of the BBC. Shamit Banerjee, a member of the BBC's board, has resigned over what he says are governance issues. Of course, his resignation follows that of the Director General, Tim Davey, and the BBC News' Chief Executive, Deborah Turness. David Sillitoe is our media and arts correspondent. Morning, David. Why is he gone? What's he said?
We're having to, I think, interpret a deal of this. I mean, the obvious. It has been a period of considerable turmoil, those two major resignations. A significant part of the BBC board now are going to be called to a common select committee on Monday. And if you ever add in a resignation from someone on the board, it does sort of raise all sorts of other questions. The two things we sort of know is one was a concern about a lack of consultation in the days leading up to the resignations of Tim Davey and Deborah Turness, the Director General and the Head of News, and also issues of governance, which is what was the BBC board during those days before those resignations. And I think we should have a little bit of context here for people who are having to try and remember what it's all about. There was a series of articles in The Telegraph based on a critique of BBC News by a former independent editorial advisor, Michael Prescott, who was concerned about a sort of bias of BBC News that he saw, a sort of institutional bias. And of course, the most pertinent fact was that identification of that 12-second clip of a Donald Trump speech, putting an amalgamation of two different parts of his speech, which the BBC admits unintentionally gave the impression of a direct call to violent action. The question is, how did all that play out over a week that on a Sunday evening, two top managers of the BBC then resigned? So it effectively parks a whole series of questions at the door of the board, this resignation, whether he intended it or not. If someone from the board resigns on a Friday evening before this Common Select Committee.
Well, indeed. I mean, the point is that Samir Shah, the chair of the board, has to face that committee of MPs on Monday. And having a fellow board member step down citing governance issues can't be helpful for him going into that encounter.
Many of the people, the first plan for this government's media select committee was that it was just going to be Michael Prescott who was going to be questioned about his concerns about the BBC. He'd been essentially taken on as an independent advisor to essentially sort of mark the homework and bring an outside perspective to sort of BBC News editorial values and an overview of it. And now we have a whole series of people being called forward. And for instance, Robbie Gibb, who of course has attracted a great deal of attention, a member of the BBC board, but also a former communications director for a Conservative government under Theresa May. So these are a whole series of people. And so what would have been maybe one question, is there something wrong with BBC News, now has, with this resignation, we have a very much a second question here. Is there something wrong with the BBC board?
Now, we did approach Shumit Banerjee for comment and not heard back. A BBC spokesman said, Mr. Banerjee today notified the BBC board of his resignation. His term on the board as a non-executive director was due to end at the end of December. And we thank him for his service. The search for replacement is well underway. We'll get the thoughts of Sir Craig Oliver, former number 10 comms person and former executive here at the BBC in the next hour.
It's 17 minutes past seven now. Yesterday in Parliament, the House of Lords tackled the key issue of coercion in a further day of debate on the assisted dying bill. The legislation would allow adults in England and Wales with less than 6 months to live the ability to ask for help to die. But backers of the bill fear that those demanding further safeguards really want to block it rather than improve it. Here's our parliamentary correspondent, Susan Hume.
There are more than 1,000 proposed changes down for debate and many hours spent on them already. So before a word was said, the government business manager, Lord Kennedy, begged for good behaviour.
Despite sincerely held views and differences of opinion, we will at all times conduct ourselves with courtesy and respect for each other and show the public watching our debates, the House of Lords, in the best possible light.
But the Terminally Ill Adults End of Life Bill is the most sensitive of issues, and there was no hurrying debate on one of the most crucial parts, whether vulnerable people might feel pressured into asking to die. There are safeguards in the bill already, but the non-party peer Lady Finlay, who's an expert in palliative care, wanted more because coercion could be very subtle. She explained what she meant.
It is the complaints about the heating bills, family carers being fed up at having to prepare drinks and food, groaning when asked for something. So many ways to give the message that you're a nuisance and would be better off dead.
A Conservative, Lord Farmer, said two friends of his with terminal illness had told him the very debate had made them feel a burden.
This bill itself, in a way, is coercive. It gives oxygen to dark thoughts, which can loom especially large when our best days seem to lie behind us.
He said it was an atheist bill that assumed there was nothing after death. Most of the peers who spoke were against the bill. Another Conservative, Lord Deben, argued that the high value of property could make some families keen to suggest elderly relatives should choose to die.
I can see people who will say, you know that your grandson is in some real difficulty. You have a last opportunity to do something worthwhile. If you die now, then your house will save his marriage, will save his firm, will look after his future. That is what will happen.
Sarah Mullally, the Bishop of London, who's soon to be the Archbishop of Canterbury, admitted something at the start of her speech.
Lordships will know that however many amendments there are to this bill, I do not feel the bill will ever be safe.
And that's why one of the bill's supporters, Labour's Lady Hayter, suspected all the proposed changes were not about improving it.
Actually, it's a way of trying to stop our discussion and proper scrutiny, because what they don't want, actually, is for the bill to go ahead.
Labour's Lord Faulkner, who's steering the bill through the Lords, agreed there needed to be safeguards against coercion, but he said those were already in the bill and he didn't want to include more subtle pressure or encouragement.
The loved ones may well, from the best motives, influence somebody to go ahead with it. I don't criticise them for that, if that is what the person wants and it helps.
Peers don't vote at this stage, so the debate wound up for now. They dealt with one group of amendments, just another 80 groups to go.
That is our parliamentary correspondent, Susan Hume. Takes us around to 21 minutes past seven.
Marjorie Taylor Greene, Trump cheerleader, MAGA firebrand, turned arch critic of the president, who recently labelled her a traitor, has resigned as Congresswoman for Georgia. She had become one of the loudest voices calling for the full release of files on the late disgraced sex offender Jeffrey Epstein, files that will now be released following a vote in Congress. But there was more to her departure than that, as was clear from a 10-minute video to X, where she explained her decision to resign.
I refuse to be a battered wife, hoping it all goes away and gets better. If I am cast aside by the president and the MAGA political machine, and replaced by neocons, big pharma, big tech, military-industrial war complex, foreign leaders, and the elite donor class that can never, ever relate to real Americans, then many common Americans have been cast aside and replaced as well.
Well, Sean Dilley is our North America correspondent. I spoke to him a little while ago and started on the background to this resignation, an almighty row with Donald Trump.
Well, the fallout between Marjorie Taylor Greene and Donald Trump was extraordinary. It shocked Capitol Hill because she was his biggest cheerleader, his biggest fan, his biggest supporter. And he had not stopped backing her despite the fact she had a history of, for example, claiming that the 9/11 terror attacks were staged, that school shootings were staged, promoting anti-Semitic conspiracy theories. But what she did have in common with Donald Trump was very much her finger on the pulse of this Make America Great Again movement, a movement that clearly is very fractured. It's not that surprising that she's now stepped down from this particular role when he's described her as wacky, he's described her as a ranting lunatic and called her Marjorie Traitor Green. So, yeah, it's what the video is intended to convey is the question. Was it a swing at the president as she's exiting the political stage or setting the political stage for something in the future?
Yeah. And how has Donald Trump responded to her resignation?
Donald Trump's first reaction in an interview with ABC was to say that it's great news for the country. And it's hardly surprising because the spat had spilt out very publicly. I think it would be wrong to put it just on the table of the Jeffrey Epstein vote a couple of weeks ago in Capitol Hill. People point to that. Marjorie Taylor Greene joined three other Republicans in supporting Democrats in attempting to force disclosure. Now, we know that Donald Trump then asked Republicans to back it. He's now signed it into law. But for some months, certainly since August, she's been highly critical that the administration hasn't done enough, in her view, to bring down that cost of living, something Donald Trump said that he would support. She's been critical of his actions on foreign policy. And what she had her eye on, no doubt, was those all-important midterm elections next year. And as it turns out, she's not going to be running in those because Donald Trump had said he would support any Republican that runs against her.
Is that the end for Marjorie Taylor Greene in terms of the political figure? Is she on manoeuvres for the future?
You never quite know what people have in mind. I mean, in the world of social media, obviously, her resignation statement was a 10-minute, 42-second video. But what strikes me as someone reporting on Capitol Hill politics and having done so in Westminster politics for many years is just how political that 10 minutes and 42 seconds was. It obviously hit out at President Trump and said that loyalty was a two-way street and that she'd spent millions of dollars supporting him when other people were stabbing him in the back. But at the same time, it spoke about a really interesting phrase. It said, common Americans and common American people. And that was a phrase that was used eight times. Now, anybody who reports on politics, anybody who follows it, knows that politicians deliberately parrot words that they want to resonate with the public. And she said that she would stand with those common American people. What that means, that's going to be interesting to find out.
Well, we should look out for that refrain. Sean Dilley, thanks very much indeed. It is 25 minutes past seven.
It's time for the sport. Carthy is here. Carthy. I mean, honestly, today was supposed to be different.
Well, we thought so. We were laughing in the office about some of the headlines yesterday morning at this time, which were disaster for England. And then by the afternoon, it totally changed. It was an extraordinary first day of the Ashes series between Australia and England. And it's turned into a pretty astonishing day two, as Anna is alluding to there, but a pretty astonishing day two for Australia. Let's get straight to Perth and Henry Moran, part of the Test Match special team, unless that's changed in the last 2 minutes. I'm not sure where to start, Henry, but we'll come back to day one. Give us a flavour of day two. Has it been any calmer?
No, not remotely. It's been another extraordinary day of cricket. One journalist in the media centre just said to me, I know what my eyes have seen. I've just got no idea how to interpret it. England went from 59 for one at lunch to holding a lead at that stage of 99 to 164 all out by tea. It set Australia a target of 205 to take a 1-0 lead in this Ashes series. And like yesterday, England's batting unit just found ways of getting out, sacrificing this strong position. Were it not for a 50-run partnership between Brydon Carse and Gus Atkinson, it's pretty likely this would have been a two-day test match. Throw in a controversial dismissal for England's Jamie Smith. The day has had it all. Australia find themselves at three without loss, chasing 205.
Yeah, it's just as extraordinary, astonishing, every other word you want to use. 19 wickets fell on day one, the most wickets on day one of an Ashes test since 1909. What was the reaction in Australia to that? Because Mitchell Starc is proving to be quite something, as we expected, isn't he?
Well, it feels a long time ago now, but bewilderment, astonishment, whatever words you want to use, really. I think England are much happier, the two sides last night. They won't be feeling that at the moment. But I think it's just been cricket in fast forward, hasn't it? There's 10,000 England supporters here in Perth. They've been in brilliant voice throughout this game. But the feeling, I think, is that we're seeing one of the most extraordinary Ashes Test matches in history. And we still don't know which way it's going to go. Australia are being very cautious early in their innings. They were like that yesterday and they fell in a heap. So we'll have to wait and see. I think we can be pretty certain, though, that we're not going to be here on day 4 and 5.
No, exactly. The beauty of sport. Henry Moran, thank you. And Henry continues on a Test Match Special. First day, day two continues on Sports Extra and BBC Sounds. Now, the Premier League returns after the international break, but Chelsea will be without their forward Cole Palmer for today's game against Burnley after he fractured his toe when he stubbed it on a door at home. Palmer had been set to resume first team training this week after 2 months out with a groin injury. Premier League champions Liverpool, currently in eighth place, host Nottingham Forest. Commentary of that game is on Five Live from 3 p.m. Rob Edwards takes charge of bottom of the table. Wolverhampton Wanderers, for the first time, they host Crystal Palace. And aiming for promotion to the Premier League are Coventry City, who are top of the Championship and face West Brom. You may have heard our interview with the sports psychologist Gilbert Anoka earlier this week, who is the man celebrated for previously turning around the mindset of the New Zealand rugby team, the All Blacks. Anoka is currently working with the England cricket team at the Ashes. He's got a bit of a job on his hands. He's also worked with Frank Lampard, the Coventry City manager, and he believes Lampard has created an All Blacks type culture at the club.
What I admired most as a coach was the openness of his mind to the methods and the ways in which you can get a group to achieve all they're capable of. And I always said the first EPL team to embrace the All Blacks type culture will get a significant advantage. And being a smart man like he is, talented like he is, and having a work ethic like he does, then he's got the essential ingredients that will create a wonderful cocktail. And he's delivering that at Coventry as we speak.
And speaking of the All Blacks, they travel to Wales following last week's defeat to England in Rugby Union's Autumn Internationals. Commentary on Sports Extra from 3:10 this afternoon. Detail of all of the weekend's rugby games on the BBC Sport website. And we have just had qualifying for Formula One's Las Vegas Grand Prix, with McLaren's Lando Norris taking pole position. The BBC's F1 commentator has the details.
A wild and wet qualifying, but the ultimate master of the conditions was the championship leader, who continues to show his rich vein of form. A seventh pole position for Lando Norris this year, ahead of Max Verstappen, with Carlos Sainz third for Williams. Oscar Piastri could only manage fifth, whilst the tricky conditions caught out Lewis Hamilton, who lines up last in his Ferrari for the first time in his career. At the front, it's Norris and Verstappen on the front row, ahead of 50 laps for the Las Vegas Grand Prix.
Harry Benjamin there, and that Las Vegas Grand Prix takes place at 4 a.m. in the morning. Might as well just not go to sleep. Formula One and Ashes overnight. Perfect.
Well, we look forward to an update on this breathless Ashes series in the next hour. Cathy, thanks very much indeed. Let's hear from Paddy O'Connell, though, who will tell us about tomorrow morning's Broadcasting House.
Hello. Land for peace. That's the long-feared vision for Ukraine. We'll weigh the options on a big weekend for power broking. An epic clash is underway in the cricket between England and Australia, but players in Suffolk plan to award their own Ashes trophy using the debris of their pavilion, which was torched by arsonists. It's underdog season generally in sport, with important football wins for Ireland and Scotland too. We'll be on Nature Watch in the Lake District National Park, and we'll ask listeners to send live temperature checks, with big swings expected on Sunday. Please warm up with BH from Sunday morning at 9.
Some warming up definitely needed today as well. The weather looks really wet. Rain will push east across England and Wales, and there'll be some scattered showers as well in the northwest.
The time is 29 minutes to 8. You're listening to Today with Anna Foster in Salford, Simon Jack in London, and Charles Carroll has a summary of the news.
Sir Keir Starmer will meet other allies of President Zelensky on the sidelines of the G20 summit in Johannesburg to discuss a peace plan for Ukraine put forward by the White House. President Trump has given Kyiv until Thursday to agree to the deal, which appears to lean heavily in Moscow's favour. Sir Keir said the UK and others would look at ways to strengthen the proposals. Talks at the COP30 climate summit in Brazil, which were due to end yesterday, have continued through the night, with no final agreement yet reached. There's division over whether any proposals should include a clear roadmap for phasing out fossil fuels. Participants say that there is a risk the talks could collapse. One of President Trump's former closest allies, the Congresswoman Marjorie Taylor Greene, has announced that she's resigning from the House of Representatives. In an angry message on social media, Ms. Taylor Greene said that she had been cast aside by the president. She'd recently been involved in a bitter falling out with Mr. Trump over his initial reluctance to support the release of documents relating to the late sex offender Jeffrey Epstein. Researchers at King's College London have given details of a clinical trial to assess the risks and benefits of puberty-blocking drugs for children and young people who are questioning their gender. The study will take place next year, involving around 220 children under the age of 16 who are going through puberty. Scientists will examine the impact of the drugs on the children's physical, social and emotional well-being. Rogue traders who sell illegal vapes could be fined £10,000 and face a possible prison sentence under plans expected to be announced in next week's budget. All vapes sold in the UK will also have to be labelled with digital technology, making it easier to spot fakes. And the first saplings grown from the felled sycamore gap tree in Northumberland are to be planted today. The famous tree stood by Hadrian's Wall for more than 100 years before being illegally chopped down in September 2023. The saplings will be planted in Coventry, Staffordshire and in Berkshire.
Thank you, Charles. It's 27 minutes to eight. A new clinical trial to assess the potential risks and potential benefits of puberty-blocking drugs for children will be carried out by researchers at King's College London. Their use has been deeply controversial and last year were restricted after a review by Dr. Hilary Cass found that there simply isn't enough clinical evidence available to show actually whether their use is a dangerous or a positive thing. Dominic Hughes is our health correspondent and that, Dominic, is why really this research, this trial is happening now, to put solid scientific clinical evidence behind this.
Yes, good morning, Annie. Yeah, exactly that. So these puberty blockers, they're also known as puberty suppressing hormones. They're drugs that are used to delay or prevent puberty happening. Now, they were used to treat those young people who were diagnosed with, who were questioning their gender and were diagnosed with either what's called gender incongruence, when someone's gender identity doesn't match the sex they were registered with at birth, or with gender dysphoria, when that causes significant distress. And the idea by those who supported the use of these drugs was it gave those young people and their families time to think, time to just pause the onset of puberty and give them time to consider what they wanted to do and to explore those questions around their gender. But as you said, their use was banned in the UK outside of clinical trials following this review that listeners might remember last year by Dr. Hilary Cass. And that found, her review found, there was insufficient evidence to say whether they were safe or not. And her review called for more research, and that's exactly what this new trial aims to do. As you say, there are very strongly held and polarised views about the risks or benefits of these drugs delaying the onset of puberty. But this research, this clinical trial, which is one of a number of different studies, is going to evolve around 226 children, they think, who are currently accessing gender services. They will have all reached puberty, but they'll be younger than 16. There's lots of very strict criteria that they have to meet. They also have to undergo intensive medical and psychological screening before they're allowed access to these puberty blockers. But the idea is then that they'll have ongoing support. And while they're on these puberty blockers, the trial is going to look at issues such as bone density, brain development, their mental health and their well-being. So this is really that effort to try and build the research base around the use of these drugs.
Dominic, thank you very much indeed for joining us. Well, Professor Emily Simonoff is Professor of Child and Adolescent Psychiatry at King's College London's Institute of Psychiatry, Psychology and Neuroscience, also the chief investigator in this study. Professor, good morning.
Good morning, Anna. Thanks for having me on.
It's really good to talk to you. And I think Dominic laid out very well there some of the issues that are going on around this, but your job now is to look at it through purely a scientific lens, not to prove or disprove anybody's theories that already exist, just to look at what impact these drugs have and whether they are a positive or a negative thing for young people.
That's exactly right, Anna. And Dominic put it very, very clearly. I think it's worth going back and saying, what do young people and parents ask us? Because Dominic highlighted those often strongly held views at either end, that these are clearly beneficial or clearly harmful. But right in the middle, young people and their parents who are attending services who have gender incongruence, which is the extreme end, the clinical diagnosis of gender distress, tell us that they don't know what to do. They look at what's out, what the information that's out there, and they don't know what's best for them. This study, alongside the other pathway studies, is really aiming to provide the same level of evidence for young people with gender incongruence as we provide for any other disorder for people attending NHS services.
Whatever conclusion you reach will be very heavily scrutinised, no doubt. So what are you putting in place to make sure that what you conclude is purely evidence-based? So people will look, for example, at the sample size, 220 or slightly over. Is that enough? They will look at the fact that there's clearly already a level of support from the young people and parents if they have chosen to take these drugs. So what are you putting in place to make sure that that evidence will stand up to the very rigorous scrutiny that it will get?
Yeah, that's a really important question. And one of those elements was, what is a sample size? And that's been chosen using the same kind of rules or indicators that we use for every other clinical trial to make sure the sample is large enough that we don't miss a true effect if it's present, and at the same time, large enough that we don't conclude that there is a positive or beneficial effect when that isn't present. Those are set rules that our methodologists use for every single study. So we've used those same rules here. Of course, this study has gone through all the usual approvals and regulatory scrutiny, which involved the Human Research Authority and the Medicines and Healthcare Regulatory Agency, sometimes known as the MHRA. And there, you know, the UK has very high levels of scrutiny of clinical trials to make sure that first they're properly conducted, but also in terms of how we think about the wide range of measures that Dominic highlighted. We're looking at young people's psychological state, emotional well-being, physical health, and quality of life, as well as, you know, any possible adverse effects here. So we're doing that in a very structured and standard way. And that's also been advised by, you know, people with lived experience, both people who have trans experience and also parents and caregivers who, you know, come from a diversity of experiences of gender diversity or gender incongruence. So it's a wide range of measures that will be very carefully monitored. The really important thing to understand here is that we're not expecting a one-size-fits-all finding necessarily. We're looking very much at the balance between possible benefits for mental health and quality of life and any possible risks or harms. Those might be to physical health. And also one of the really important things we're doing is looking at whether there are any possible risks to brain development by doing the first ever study looking at cognitive development, that's thinking, learning, and memory, and at the same time, scanning brains of young people who are getting puberty-suppressing hormones and those who are not. That's the first time that's ever been done.
We spoke to Dr. Hilary Cass about this, and she talked about the fact that her review had uncovered a very weak evidence base for the benefits, that some children had had more negative than positive effects. And she is very pleased that this work is taking place. And she is actually very pleased that you and the team at King's College London are doing it. She says you're one of the best in the country for this kind of trial. But I wonder, just stepping away from the scientific element of it for one moment, and Dominic, as we said, explained very well the really strong feelings on both sides when it comes to this. And I wonder, just for you as a researcher, how does it feel to be taking something on that does come with an increased level of scrutiny? And also, we've seen at times in this debate as well that there can be abuse attached to people who take on work like yours.
I'm very proud to be the chief investigator for the Pathway Study. I recognize it's an extremely important question. It's very important for the young people and their parents who are at the moment really uncertain what kind of health care to opt for. And what we hope is that the Pathway Studies, the trial plus the wider studies that we're doing, will allow us to give young people experiencing gender incongruence and their families, as well as the doctors who are treating them, much better information about treatment moving forward.
Professor Emily Simonoff, the chief investigator of the study, thanks for your time this morning.
Very nearly 70 minutes to 8. Quick look at this morning's papers. The proposed US deal to end the war in Ukraine is the main story for several. The Times says Britain and other European allies are scrambling to strengthen the plan, their words, with concern Ukraine would be at risk of further attacks if it weakened its armed forces. Trump turns the screw is the main headline in the Daily Mail, which says President Zelensky faces an agonising choice between accepting what the paper calls a humiliating peace deal or losing US support. It also highlights that the plan includes US deals with Russia for rare earth minerals. And The Sun claims that the former Duchess of York, Sarah Ferguson, is looking for financial offers for a tell-all TV interview after what the paper calls her public downfall over her links to Jeffrey Epstein. US channels are said to be willing to offer six-figure sums.
It is 17 minutes to 8. The newly appointed president of the World Association of Zoos has said there are many around the world, and some here in the UK as well, that he would like to see closed down. This is about animal welfare. The government here is bringing in stricter regulations about the conditions that animals should be kept in, but of course those vary in different countries. And David Field joins us this morning, CEO at the Royal Zoological Society of Scotland, president of the World Association of Zoos and Aquariums. Good morning.
Good morning. Good to talk to you.
It's lovely to talk to you. People might raise an eyebrow. They might be surprised at the idea that somebody in your new role might be talking about closing down zoos. But it's, as we said, it's a little more nuanced than that.
Indeed it is. I mean, there are some amazingly fantastic zoos across the globe. And here in the UK, we've got some wonderful zoos like, I would say my own, but Edinburgh, Chester, Twycross. We've got some great new zoos in the UK, like Northumberland Zoo, Wingham Wildlife Park, Jimmy's Farm. And all of these zoos share one good thing. They are really advancing, progressing welfare, and really committing to conservation impact. They're all part of associations like the British Association or the European Association of Zoos, and also the World Association of Zoos. And what we are doing is setting global benchmarks for the highest standards in zoos, going beyond legal frameworks. So I'm really calling on...
What can you do? Yeah, what can you do about the places that aren't? Because often they are the ones that attract the attention.
They are indeed. Well, I think our first step is to engage, is not to turn our backs on them, but go approach, set out these global benchmarks, set out the ways that they can improve. And if these zoos want to improve and are willing to improve, and whether they are private zoos or whether they're government-run zoos, if they're willing to engage, we can support, we can show the ways, we can demonstrate best practice. But if they're not willing to do that, then I think their very social license to operate, their very existence, should be called into question.
There are people who do question that, actually, whether zoos still have a place in society nowadays, whether they still fulfil a function, or whether animals should always be in their natural environment.
And, you know, I get that. I do appreciate for some people there is an ethical stance. But the conservation authorities, the World Conservation Union, the IUCN, have actually called on zoos for our unique role in conservation. And only recently at the World Conservation Congress in Abu Dhabi, zoos, good zoos, were at the forefront of conservation and at the forefront of seeing animals being returned to the wild. For instance, the scimitar horned oryx. Zoos played an integral role in not just breeding, but the genetic management of populations and the return of these animals back to the wild.
David Field, really interesting to talk to you. Thank you for joining us, new president of the World Association of Zoos and Aquariums. It's 14 minutes to 8 now. It's time for Thought for the Day. And the speaker this morning is Brian Draper, associate lecturer at the London Institute for Contemporary Christianity.
Good morning. As a Christian, the buccaneering English cricketer of old, Dickie Dodds, once asked God how he should play the game. Cricket is God's game, after all. He says he heard this in reply, "Hit the ball hard and enjoy it." As the first Ashes Test match exploded into life yesterday, it feels as if the current English team led by Ben Stokes carries that spirit in them. Their exuberant brand of cricket is so infectiously entertaining, albeit so often tough for the nerves of those of us who love to watch it. The Ashes is one of the world's great crucibles of sporting intensity, with its fierceness, its beauty, its combat. But what helps to make it so captivating and transcendent, I think, is the spirit of cricket too, that intangible, enduring something which guides the game's conscience, but for me takes us deeper still. The very fact that we'll be talking about it, if and when that spirit is broken, speaks of how much it really matters. Many fans are still discussing an unfair dismissal from the last time the teams met 2 years ago, which just wasn't cricket. The former England captain and psychiatrist Mike Brearley has spoken helpfully of how cricket's dilemmas, such as whether you walk or not if you know you're out, reflect human matters of honesty, integrity, generosity that apply to each of us. I find it fascinating how instinctively we seem to know what's good and fair and right, how we have it within us, whether we then choose to play with a straight bat or not. And I'm reminded theologically of the way Celtic Christianity in particular has always held that we are born not with original sin, which cheats us, but original blessing, which guides us, because we are part of God's good creation. As the Celtic expert John Philip Newell writes, what is deepest in us corresponds to what is true. Even though we so often live from the surface of things and forget who and whose we really are. I love how cricket has its laws, yet also its spirit, which can take you beyond merely rule-keeping for the sake of it, and into a love for the goodness of the game that now and again releases an electrifying and joyous freedom too. And it reminds me that Jesus didn't come to do away with God's law, summed up as love God and love each other, but to fulfil it, to embody the spirit of life which brings us freedom, as the Apostle Paul said, freedom to live well and to love, freedom to hit the ball hard and enjoy it.
That was Thought for the Day with Brian Draper, Associate Lecturer at the London Institute for Contemporary Christianity. It is nearly 10 to 8.
And all that cricket chat made me just want to check the Ashes score, because it's 35 without loss. Australia chasing a target of 205, because Carthy got me so excited about it earlier on with all the drama that's been going on. 35 without loss, chasing 205. But now at 10 to 8, let us turn our thoughts to Brazil, where the big environmental summit that happens every 2 years, the COP summit, has run to overtime as countries frantically try and agree the wording of a text that the countries attending will try and work towards in their efforts to mitigate climate change. Now, there is disagreement over whether to even mention fossil fuels, which seems quite weird, and negotiations were meant to end at 9 o'clock yesterday. Laura Young is an environmental scientist and climate activist from Scotland who's at the talks in Brazil. And I know we spoke to you, Laura, on your way out to COP30. And we also speak to Tom Rivett-Carnac, former political strategist for the UN Framework for the Convention on Climate Change, one of the architects of the Paris Climate Accord, which is over 10 years ago now. Laura, first of all, just paint a picture for us of what it's like there, this frantic kind of scurrying around trying to get a text agreed, because it's quite oddly taking place aboard two cruise ships, which are not without their own carbon footprints, of course. What's going on right now?
Well, of course, we are here in Belém in Brazil at the heart of the Amazon. So this conference has definitely had a nature focus, as we see on our doorstep the planet that we are trying to protect. But this has of course been 2 weeks of busy negotiations. It's always pretty hectic, even from the start of the leaders summit, which was actually on the 6th and 7th of November, and we're now on the 22nd of November. So we've had a busy 2 weeks of negotiations, but the final couple of days are always the busiest, and it actually most years overruns. It's overrun up to, I think it's about 44 hours has been the longest it's ever run. But yes, yesterday we did have these frantic negotiations trying to get a final draft of an agreement that all of the countries in the UN process can agree to. And as you've mentioned, we did not get to that point. So negotiators were sent home. Everybody really was sent home and was told to return in basically an hour's time. We are 3 hours behind here in Brazil, to keep negotiating, because the text that was put forward was just not good enough. It lacked so much substance, so much, any sort of progress really from final years. And that is the position we are sitting at here Saturday morning.
Well, it also lacked the work, you know, any mention of fossil fuels in the latest draft, or as we're told, which seems to anyone listening absurd, frankly, for a climate change conference.
Exactly. Climate change 101 is that fossil fuels is the leading cause of climate change, with the greenhouse gases that are emitted when we are flying and driving and using fossil fuels for industry. But it actually took to COP26, which was held in Glasgow in 2021, for fossil fuels to be put into the text. And so it actually took us a really long time to even acknowledge it. But as you've mentioned, this new text does not have reference to that. It shows the strength of some of these petrochemical states and how much influence they have, that they can really put pressure on these negotiations to not include what we would say is the blindingly obvious and leave many countries, the ones who are frankly being devastated by climate change, scratching their heads and really trying to build coalitions to say that that is just not good enough.
Okay, well, stay with us, Laura. Let's bring in Tom Rivett-Carnac. This seems such a sort of absurd omission, given the fact that it has been mentioned in previous COPs, much to the chagrin of some oil producers, that it not making the text this time. One wonders, this is COP30, there's been no appreciable impact on carbon emissions. One wonders whether there's any point in it, Tom.
Well, I think on the fossil fuel point, it was absolutely mentioned a couple of years ago in Dubai, albeit in a relatively high level and oblique way, with a generalized sense that we should do something. And the attempt to come back together here in Belém in Brazil is to make that practical and say, well, what are the roadmaps? What do those steps really look like? And, you know, as heartbreaking as it is, the UNFCCC operates by consensus. 190, used to be 195, now 194 countries without the US and the Paris Agreement have to come together and agree. And many countries' livelihoods depend on fossil fuels, and so they resist. And so, you know, we need to find strategies that enable us to move beyond that. And unfortunately, with the departure of the US, we've lost one of the most powerful. I mean, in the years when I was involved in the COPs, when the US is really behind an agreement and really wants to make it happen and is prepared to exert its economic authority in bringing, for example, the Saudi Arabians around, then we can really do things. But the trouble at the moment, and I think the issue that we're experiencing in Brazil, is that we don't have that big push from the US, and there is an emboldened attitude amongst the oil-producing countries who feel there won't be a consequence for them if they delay. So I think that's one of the things that's happening. I would resist, however, for your assessment as to whether is there any point. And I would also resist...
It was a question rather than an assessment, but...
I see, right, yes. I would also resist the idea that this is kind of win or lose in the next 24 hours. So quite a lot happens at these COPs. You know, we have, for years, we talked about how do we set goals. Now we're moving towards how do we actually go forward and achieve them. And over the last 2 weeks, you see alliances come together on things like methane and health, you know, progress made on the integration of cities. So for a long time with the COPs, we've ended up seeing them as these binary outcome moments at the end. Do we get a gaveling moment or do we not? And of course, we hope that will happen. But actually, we've moved into an era of implementation, which is messier. It's more complicated, and progress is happening. But in a way, the fights we're seeing in Belém now are as a result of the fact that we're getting to the important things.
But if you haven't got the US, as you've pointed out there, China have sent a very low-level delegation there. Those are the two biggest emitters in the world. Those are two very big empty seats at the table, which makes it feel like the other things, the other progress you talk about, is really meddling around at the margins.
Well, I mean, China is actually pretty serious about this. And despite the fact they didn't send anyone at head of state level, you know, there's a lot of evidence to suggest that they've peaked their emissions. And we'll begin to see the evidence of that in the coming years. So countries are serious about this transition. And we are now seeing, you know, real implementation happen at the national level. Of course, it's not enough. And of course, there is a really sobering moment happening in BLM where we look at the national commitments, we realize they don't add up to keeping us to 1.5. And that, as that sort of penetrates all of our consciousness about what that might mean for all of us, that should precipitate a moment of global reflection around the fact that we're not performing the task that is really left to us as our generation.
So you think
the
Paris 1.5 degree promise will still have significance as we sail past it? Is that what you're saying?
Well, the scientists now are saying that in order for us to keep to 1.5, we are going to need to engage in large scale removals, and that's been true for a couple of years. That is technically possible, but once we get to the point that in order to keep us to within safe climate limits, we're sucking emissions back out of the atmosphere, on one level we failed, and we need to, you know, that should be even more incentive to say we need to get on top of dealing with this now rather than leaving that problem for what will become even more formidable later.
Okay, Laura, I hope you're still there. I just wonder whether, do you get disheartened by the fact that you see this year in, year out, that there's no appreciable impact on emissions, and will you be going again?
It is, of course, incredibly frustrating. I'll give you my age as well, because I'm 29. So this thing has been going on since before I was on this planet. So it can feel frustrating thinking that we haven't got to some of the obvious points that we need to reach. But also, partly I'm here as an ambassador for Tear Fund, who are an NGO who work in some of the countries that are devastated by climate change.
Sounds like, Laura, I'm going to have to say we're running out of time, sadly, but it sounds like you will be back for more. Laura Young, Tom Rivett-Carnock, thank you.
The stories we tell.
About the people we know.
And the places we love.
Are not just made here.
They're stories made of here.
The British Isles are globally important for nature.
Yeah, we might find that kid who's got the raw talent, who's in a back street in Preston somewhere. That'd be amazing.
The thing is,
we're moving back to Barry.
What?
Made of Belfast.
Liverpool, Cornwall, Glasgow.
Newcastle.
Cardiff.
Made of here.
Because this is our BBC.
Let's check the weekend weather. Simon King's here. Morning.
Good morning, Anna. Yeah, a very different feel to the weather this weekend. Of course, this week we've had that cold northerly Arctic airflow. This weekend it's more of a southwesterly, but that brings with it some rain, and it's certainly a very wet start today across many parts of England and Wales. The rain is moving its way gradually eastward, so while still drier towards East Anglia and the southeast of England, you'll see that rain pushing in the next few hours, and it's going to linger on really across these eastern areas well into the afternoon. But for parts of southwest England through West Wales and northern England, there will be some sunny spells developing, but maximum temperatures getting up to about 7 to 12 degrees, not feeling as cold. For Northern Ireland, there'll be some sunny spells here with highs of 7 or 8 Celsius. And across Scotland, while it's quite cloudy to start off this morning, a few showers in northern and western areas, those will continue into the afternoon, but elsewhere there'll be some sunny spells developing with highs of 5 to 9 Celsius.
Thank you, Simon. You're listening to Today on BBC Radio 4 with Simon Jack and Anna Foster.
Good morning. The headlines this morning. Sir Keir Starmer is to join European allies to discuss their reaction to the White House plan to end the war in Ukraine, which endorses key Russian demands. We'll hear from a former special representative to Ukraine under President Trump and get a sense of Ukrainian public opinion. Negotiators at the COP30 climate talks are trying to salvage a deal, with delegates divided over whether to mention fossil fuels in the final text. And the Republican politician who was once one of Donald Trump's staunchest allies, Marjorie Taylor Greene, is resigning from Congress after her public feud with the president.
Also on the programme in the next hour, our Saturday panel will reflect on the big stories of the week, including that damning COVID inquiry report. And the Spanish singer-songwriter Rosalía's new genre-defying album's taken the music world by storm. We will speak to one of the violinists from the London Symphony Orchestra who's featured on it.
And I'm Cathy Nyana-Segrin with your Saturday Sport. It's only day two of the first Ashes test, but it's continuing in the thrilling way it started. England all out for 164 in their second innings, leaving Australia needing 205 to win. They're well on their way. We'll have the details in 25 minutes.
The BBC News is read for us this morning by Charles Carroll.
The Prime Minister is due to meet key European allies of Ukraine at the G20 summit in South Africa to work out a response to the US-drafted plan to end the war with Russia. Last night, Donald Trump insisted President Zelensky needed to accept the deal, which appears to be tipped heavily in Moscow's favour. Sir Keir Starmer said the talks on the margins of the summit would look at creating the space for what he called meaningful peace negotiations. Our political editor Chris Mason is travelling with the Prime Minister and has sent this report from Johannesburg.
This is a summit President Trump has declined to attend, and yet his actions are shaping its most salient discussions. Ukraine's allies here are scrambling to react to the White House's plan, keen to appear constructive in public, while some are clearly horrified in private. In support of President Trump's push for peace, the Prime Minister said, his discussions with other leaders here would look at how we can strengthen this plan. The widely leaked US draft includes proposals that Kyiv had previously ruled out, ceding eastern areas it now controls, significantly cutting the size of its army, and pledging not to join NATO. President Trump has set a deadline of Thursday for President Zelensky to agree. At the White House last night, he put more pressure on the Ukrainian leader.
At some point, he's going to have to accept something. You know, he hasn't accepted. You remember right in the Oval Office not so long ago, I said, you don't have the cards.
President Zelensky has said Ukraine faces one of the most difficult moments in its history. His country, he said, might face a very difficult choice, either losing dignity or risk losing a key partner in America.
Talks at the COP30 climate summit in Brazil have continued through the night to try to settle a dispute over whether to mention fossil fuels in the final agreement. The meeting was due to end yesterday evening, but ran into overtime, with representatives inside the negotiating room saying the talks had become very difficult. Our climate editor, Justin Rolat, reports from the summit in Belém.
These talks have ground to a standstill over a question that is likely to seem absurd to most people. Given fossil fuels are the main driver of climate change, surely it shouldn't be controversial to mention them in the final text of the world's main climate summit, not least because the need to phase them out was agreed at a COP 2 years ago. But a group made up of fossil fuel producing countries and their allies, including Saudi Arabia, is understood to have been refusing even to discuss the words being mentioned. Meanwhile, countries led by the European Union and including the UK is equally adamant they should be included. If a compromise can't be found, there is a risk the conference could fail and call into question the entire COP process itself.
One of President Trump's former closest allies, Marjorie Taylor Greene, has announced that she's resigning from the House of Representatives. She'd been involved in a bitter falling out with Mr. Trump recently over his initial refusal to support the release of documents relating to the late sex offender Jeffrey Epstein. In an angry and lengthy message on social media, the former star of the MAGA movement said loyalty should be a two-way street.
Standing up for American women who were raped at 14 years old, trafficked and used by rich, powerful men, should not result in me being called a traitor and threatened by the President of the United States, whom I fought for.
Researchers at King's College London have given details of a clinical trial to assess the risks and benefits of puberty-blocking drugs for children and young people who are questioning their gender. The first patients are to be recruited in the new year, as our health correspondent Dominic Hughes reports.
The team behind this trial say there are strongly held and polarised views about the risk of drugs which delay the onset of puberty for young people unhappy with or questioning their gender. Their use was banned in the UK outside of clinical trials following a review by Dr. Hilary Cass last year that found there was insufficient evidence to say they were safe and which called for more research. This new clinical trial, one of a number of studies, will involve around 220 children who are currently accessing gender services. They will have all reached puberty but will be younger than 16 and will have to meet strict criteria and undergo intensive medical and psychological screening before they're allowed to access puberty blockers. They'll have ongoing support while the trial will look at issues such as bone density, brain development and mental health and well-being. The first results should be available in around 4 years. But the contentious nature of any work in this area is clear. There have already been calls for the trial to be halted on the grounds that it's unlawful and unethical.
Rogue traders who sell illegal vapes could be fined £10,000 and face a possible prison sentence under plans expected to be announced in next week's budget. All vapes sold in the UK will also have to be labelled with digital technology, making it easier to spot fakes. More details from our business correspondent, Mark Ashdown.
It's thought that one in 10 adults in Britain vapes. After banning the sale and supply of single-use e-cigarettes in the summer, the government is now promising to crack down on illegal products sold on the black market. From next October, traders will need to have a mandatory licence, and more rigorous right-to-work checks will be introduced to try to stamp out tax evasion and exploitation. E-cigarettes will need to carry a cutting-edge digital duty stamp, including a QR code, in order to show they comply with safety and sales regulations. Legitimate businesses will be able to register for the new scheme from April next year before it becomes compulsory in the autumn. They will also have 6 months to sell any unstamped stock.
A charity is warning that victims of fraud are being failed by the criminal justice system. Victim Support helps hundreds of thousands of people in England and Wales each year and says that more needs to be done to tackle the problem. Figures suggest only a small fraction of frauds committed each year end in a prosecution. Here's Dan Whitworth from Radio 4's Moneybox.
Fraud is the most common crime across the UK, and its impact can be devastating, not just financial, but emotionally and mentally too. Most cases aren't reported because of feelings such as embarrassment, guilt and shame, as well as victim blaming. But in the year to June, there were 1.2 million recorded cases of fraud in England and Wales. During the same period, there were fewer than 13,000 fraud prosecutions, according to statistics from the Ministry of Justice. Victim Support wants more funding for victim services, more resources put into the investigation and detection of fraud, and greater cooperation beyond policing boundaries. The Home Office says it's determined to bring those responsible to justice and will publish an ambitious fraud strategy in the new year, which will aim to reduce fraud, target offenders, and protect victims.
The first saplings grown from the felled Sycamore Gap tree in Northumberland are to be planted today. The famous tree stood by Hadrian's Wall for more than 100 years before two men illegally chopped it down in September 2023. The saplings have been grown from the seeds and material rescued from the tree. Here's our North of England correspondent, Danny Savage.
It took just a few minutes for the famous Sycamore Gap tree to be destroyed in the dead of night with a chainsaw. The actions of Daniel Graham and Adam Carruthers caused a national outcry. They are both now serving prison sentences for their actions. National Trust experts were quick to salvage parts of the tree and grow saplings which are now between 4 and 6 feet tall. The so-called Trees of Hope will now be planted across the country. There are 49 of them to mark the sycamore's height in feet when it was felled. Today we'll see one planted at the tree sanctuary in Coventry, along with others at the site of a mining disaster in Staffordshire and at Greenham Common in Berkshire. More saplings will be planted over the course of the week.
In the cricket, England have slumped from 65 for 1 to 164 all out in their second innings in the first Ashes test in Australia. In one extraordinary passage of play after lunch, they lost 4 wickets in about 12 minutes. Australia are now batting for the second time in Perth and are chasing 205 to win. A judge in the US state of Missouri has resigned after he was disciplined for wearing an Elvis wig in court and occasionally playing the singer's songs during proceedings. Judge Matthew E.P. Thornhill said that his aim had been to add levity at times when he thought that it could help to relax litigants. But a disciplinary commission found that he had failed to maintain order and decorum in the courtroom.
Charles, thank you very much indeed. It is 8:10 now. Ukraine is facing one of the most difficult moments in its history, so says President Zelensky. The ceasefire plan he's been presented with by the US involves ceding part of the country to Russia, even some areas that they haven't yet taken, reducing the size of the Ukrainian army and committing not to join NATO. Russia would get to rejoin the G7 and have all sanctions on it lifted. Ukraine's European allies have stopped short so far of public condemning the plan, even though it goes against many of the principles that they've stated over and over again. But they do say that they will discuss it on the sidelines of the G20 summit later. President Zelensky was frank about Ukraine's limited options.
Now is one of the most difficult moments in our history. Now, the pressure on Ukraine is one of the most difficult. Now, Ukraine may find itself facing a very difficult choice, either the loss of dignity or the risk of losing a key partner, either the difficult 28 points or an extremely difficult winter, the most difficult, and further risks.
Difficult. The key word there, a difficult choice, President Zelensky saying. Well, I spoke earlier to Kurt Volker, who is a former United States special representative for Ukraine. He was appointed by President Trump in his first term. And he spelled out the ways in which Ukraine loses out and Russia gains in this new US proposed deal.
It is an incredibly one-sided agreement. It places restrictions only on Ukraine, none on Russia. It says that Ukraine is going to be sovereign, but then it outlines all these ways in which Ukraine's sovereignty is actually limited. No commitment from Russia not to invade again, just an expectation that Russia will not do so, which is different than a commitment. So there are just so many things, amateurish and ill-informed, poorly constructed and one-sided in this proposal. It's hard to see how anyone in the White House could actually think that this goes anywhere. And to me, that raises the next question, which is, well, then why would they propose this? If they're smart enough to know that this is dead on arrival, then why would they even do it? And one reason, perhaps, is to get Ukraine to say no, so they can blame Ukraine for the failure of peace rather than Russia or President Trump. Another reason, perhaps, is to set up Witkoff and Vance and say, okay, you guys think you're so smart, go try it, see what happens.
You mentioned the US Vice President J.D. Vance. Actually, as we're speaking, there is a new line that's just come through from him. He says any plan to end the war should preserve Ukrainian sovereignty, be acceptable to both countries. But he says that it was a fantasy to think that Ukraine could win if the US just gave Kyiv more money or more weapons or imposed more Russian sanctions. So he's not entirely wrong in that assertion, but it still doesn't really explain, does it, as you pointed out, the inequality of this ceasefire proposal that's on the table.
Yeah, well, even in those few statements that you read that he apparently said, there are their own contradictions in there. So say any plan has to be acceptable to both sides. Well, Russia has maximalist demands on eliminating Ukraine as a state, as a national identity, and so forth. That will never be acceptable to Ukraine. So unless you are going to go along with something that is unacceptable to Ukraine, you're going to be preserving Ukrainian sovereignty, which he says, meaning that that is unacceptable to Russia.
What about Europe, Ambassador Volker? Because they have obviously rallied around Kyiv, they've rallied around President Zelensky, and their response to this in the last 24 hours or so has been far, far less clear than yours is just now. They're talking about meeting in the margins of the G20, but nobody has said the obvious, which is this is not an acceptable deal to us or to Ukraine. Why aren't they saying that?
Right. I think that I'll be fair to European leaders. I think they want to handle this privately. I don't think they think it's in Europe's interest to go public and just blast this plan and blast the Trump administration. They would rather have a private discussion and come up with alternatives. And I think diplomatically, that's probably the right thing to do. That being said, I do believe that if this plan were to be implemented, it would create the risk, a much greater risk, of a wider European war in the not-too-distant future, because Russia would be vindicated for its aggression against Ukraine. It would have the time and space to build up its military forces again. There would be no accountability for any war crimes committed. And this would put Europe in a much more dangerous position with the risk of Russian aggression than if this plan were to be stopped. So I do think there is a direct European interest in making sure that this plan does not go forward. But how they go about that and choosing to do it privately behind closed doors is probably the right choice, at least at this stage.
You know President Trump, and ultimately it's his decisions that are driving this. I wondered, do you think his taste for fixing things, for being the peacemaker, for trying to bring ceasefires and end wars, has taken over to an extent where he just wants to try and solve everything, regardless of whether or not that solution is the right one?
I think that you're right in saying that he wants to be the peacemaker, the one who solves the intractable problems, the one who does what no one else could do. That is certainly the case. In the case of Russia and Ukraine, he has been all over the place. He has been critical of Russia. He's been critical of Ukraine. He has supported pressure on Russia. He's urged lifting of sanctions on Russia. He goes back and forth on all this. I think it's all tactical in order to try to figure out where is the space for an agreement. In that context, I think that this peace plan, which I have to stress was put forward by Steve Witkoff and Vice President Vance more than President Trump. I think President Trump's view on this is, well, give it a try and see what happens. But then he also has some ability to distance himself from this in the future if he chooses to. And in fact, it may be that he finds it necessary to do that not too long from now.
Ambassador Kurt Volker, really appreciate your insight. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
One of the key elements of this, of course, is how it will be received in Ukraine. And Anton Grushetsky is executive director of the Kyiv International Institute of Sociology. He's also a pollster. And he told me where public opinion in Ukraine sits on this ceasefire proposal.
People in Ukraine are ready even for the hard decisions, but not for peace under any costs. And what is important, it's, for example, the mention of security guarantees. And even current plan, it's not providing any security guarantees to Ukraine. It's like zero guarantees and other Budapest memorandum that provided Ukraine zero in exchange of nuclear weapons. So people say, yes, you could accept like freezing the front line. You could accept some other demands. But ceding territory and actually receiving nothing, it's not okay. So the plan that is being discussed right now, quite similar plan we were asked in September, and over 70% of Ukrainians said it's not acceptable.
How much power does President Zelensky have to accept this? Because doesn't part of it need to go to the Ukrainian people to be voted on?
First of all, we are a parliamentary republic, and besides presidents, we need a parliament to vote for such a plan. And it won't be voted in the parliament, because the majority of MPs understand it's not acceptable for the people. And even if we have a referendum, the majority would vote against such a plan that's described right now. So yes, people, if there are plans people could vote for. For example, Ukrainian and European plan proposed in September and August, it's okay for people, for like freezing the front line, some security guarantees, de facto Russian control over the occupied areas, people could accept it. But not the current version that actually is a big lie.
How do people in Ukraine view the US? Because they have been a key ally, a key partner, they've shared intelligence, they've shared weaponry. But now this deal comes down very much on the side of Russia.
Unfortunately, yeah, you're right, and it's perceived in this way by Ukrainians. On the one hand, 90% of Ukrainians has a favorable view of ordinary Americans, and in general, around 70% have a favorable view of the U.S. So Ukrainians still say it's a good country, good with good people. But we have only like 20-25% who have a favorable view of the American leadership. So people say, yes, they are good people, but the leadership, unfortunately, is not our ally. At the same time, around 80% says that even if U.S. halts all the support to Ukraine, we should still continue resistance with our European allies. Okay, we understand we cannot achieve the full victory right now, but with our European allies, we could achieve better peace deals than what is pressed by the U.S. administration.
So do you think people in Ukraine feel that there is a world in which they could turn away from the US, reject this deal, and that European support on its own would be enough?
Yes, and actually since February, people were disillusioned with the US, And much more people saying, yes, we are part of Europe and we should collaborate, first of all, with Europe. And there are like lots of possibilities with European assistance. And actually, the Spiral Initiative, other support from the European Union, European States, the United Kingdom, we are able to resist aggression. Again, not to win the war, we understand it, we could do it, but in the current situation, it's not possible, but we could have better conditions that US trying to pressure Ukraine.
Anton Grushetsky, thank you for joining us. Thank you.
Thank you.
Well, that was the thoughts of really what is happening inside Ukraine. And that's a really key part of it. Anton Grushetsky there, who is a pollster, who knows what people are thinking and who articulated there, as you heard, this difficult choice between people who want the war to end, but who crucially want security guarantees and don't want to give up Ukrainian land as a result. It is, as President Zelensky said, a difficult moment ahead for Ukraine.
22 minutes past eight. There's more trouble at the top of the BBC. Board member Shumit Banerjee has resigned as a board member over what he describes as governance issues. It follows the resignation, of course, of Director General Tim Davie and the Chief Executive of BBC News, Deborah Turness, as a result of that Panorama episode that spliced together clips of a 2021 Donald Trump speech in a way that was judged and conceded by the BBC to be potentially misleading. Well, Mr. Banerjee's departure comes before the Chair of the board, Samir Shah, appears before a committee of MPs on Monday. We'll get the thoughts of Sir Craig Oliver, former editor of the BBC 6 and 10 o'clock news and director of politics and communication at Number 10 in a moment. But Katie Razzles, our culture and media editor. Katie, Mr. Banerjee's departure, what do we know for the reasons he's given?
Well, Simon, for full transparency, I haven't seen his resignation letter. I was told about its contents and we broke the story last night. But it does look time to put pressure, as you say, ahead of the critical Select Committee meeting on Monday, in which MPs will question, amongst others, the chair of the BBC, Samir Shah, and another board member, Sir Robbie Gibb, the ex-BBC executive and former Downing Street director of communications to Theresa May. So there are two specific critiques Mr. Banerjee has made. And one is that he was not consulted about the events that led up to the resignations of the director general and the head of news. We don't know the full facts around that. I understand he was abroad at the time, but if it's correct that the BBC lost not one, but two top executives, and one of the board members says they weren't consulted, that is damaging. And then the other one seems to be his claim that there are governance issues. And it's not entirely clear what he means, but an insider told me Mr. Banerjee was known to be angry that the BBC chair, Samir Shah, was, in Mr. Banerjee's view, weak in not challenging a number of other board members and their assertion about systemic bias at BBC News. I'm sure that would be rejected by Mr. Shah. And of course, Tim Davie, Deborah Turness, and indeed Samir Shah have rejected the claim that BBC News is institutionally biased. But that does seem to be at the heart of it all. After, as you say, that leaked memo by the former independent external advisor Michael Prescott made various claims of systemic issues at the BBC, including that misleading edit of the Donald Trump speech in the Panorama. Mm. And as the fallout on the memo has spread, some have characterised it in this way, that the four political appointees to the board, Samir Shah is the fifth, have coalesced around the view that the BBC too often suffers from liberal groupthink. Others have told me the chair has been unable to steer the board to a place of consensus. Whatever the truth, the timing of this resignation does look bad for Mr. Shah and the BBC.
Katie, thanks. Katie Razzle, our culture and media editor. Sir Craig Oliver, do you agree? Bad timing for Shah? What can he do? Is there anything he can do in front of MPs to cauterise this trauma, if you like?
Yeah, well, no, I agree. I think the stakes were already high for Samir Shah, and they've just got even higher. And the BBC risks the prospect of not only having seen the Director General and the CEO of News go, but perhaps even after this, the Chairman of the Board of Governors. What Shumit Banerjee is saying, you know, as the governance issues and that he wasn't consulted, is really code for saying that he thinks there's been weakness and a lack of grip. And I think Samir Shah is going to have to try and show people that that isn't the case. That's going to be quite a difficult thing, I suspect. Mm.
Tim Davie, of course, is still in post. He's going to be leaving in January. Does he have any role between now and then?
Not really. I think when somebody leaves their post or says that they're going to leave their post, everybody, the power sort of leaks away, basically, and that they're not really in a leadership position anymore. But I do think all eyes are going to be on Samir Shah on Monday. And the questions I think he's going to really have to answer are, is it true that months ago you chaired a BBC meeting where Panorama issue was on the table and you decided to take no action? And if so, why particularly after what you've now said, did you not take action then? And I think that the next question he's going to really have to face is that when Michael Prescott's report was leaked to the Telegraph, why did you preside over such a long period of time of the BBC not coming out, particularly when the executive wanted to get out and cauterise the issue as cleanly as possible?
And of course, all of this comes with the spectre of charter renewal coming down the track at the same time. So in a way, the timing for this couldn't be worse.
The timing is terrible. And I think that the problem is that we've had this period which is rolling and we're speculating about what's going to happen. This issue doesn't feel like it's finished yet by a long way. And meanwhile, people who are enemies of the BBC, people who don't like it, are able to say, look, there is chaos, there are problems, and that the story of whether or not there's systemic bias runs on. The issue of dealing with that lands at the door of the chair of the Board of Governors. And so far, it looks like it's been very weak, and he's failed to actually get under control of the board. He should, I think, in this situation have said, this is what we're doing. If you have to resign over it, then so be it. But my job is to protect the BBC by taking tough and clear action immediately. That didn't happen.
And of course, the BBC apologised about the Panorama and the splicing of the Trump interview. But is there a danger that it gets seen to have kind of apologised for a lot, cops it for the lot of everything that Michael Prescott said about bias within the BBC? And that's something that either Samir Shah or somebody else is going to have to address.
Well, the BBC's been left in the position where those who wish to do it damage can say exactly that, and they can continue to keep making those points. As I say, there is a need at this moment, or has been for some time, for the person who leads the governance of the BBC to grip it hard and say, right, we are drawing a line, this is what's going to happen. Very, very early in the process, he should have knocked heads together, said, look, we're drawing a line, there's clarity on this, let's move on. That didn't happen. And you see what happens when you fail to take a grip is that you end in situations where a board member is resigning on the eve of a select committee appearance in order to cause problems for you.
So Craig Oliver, former editor of the BBC 6 and 10 o'clock news and former director of communications at Number 10. Thank you.
Sports at 28 minutes past eight. I don't even want Carthy to suggest or hint at anything that might be happening at the Ashes, because by the time I get to the end of the sentence, it'll probably be out of date.
Yep, that's what it's been like for the last 24 hours, pretty much. Day two of this first Ashes test between Australia and England has picked up exactly where an extraordinary day one finished. Jonathan Agnew has put down his test match special mic for a moment to join us. Jonathan, how many Ashes series have you covered and how does this compare as a start?
I think this is number 19, actually, since you asked. Certainly 10 here. No, it's been a manic couple of days. I mean, this game could possibly end today, and not with the result that people at home listening in would necessarily want if it were to, because Australia have made a terrific start, a real onslaught, really, on their target of 205. Travis Head, the mid-order batsman, left-handed free-scoring player, was promoted to open the batting, and he scored 50 from 41 balls. It's really punctured a hole in this target. A complete contrast, really, to how Australia were in their first innings when they got rolled over. They couldn't, they can't score a run. They were so bogged down. They were bowled out for 132 in the end. They added just 8 runs this morning. But Head has come out there and he's really played in a liberated fashion. He liberated his teammate, the debutant Weatherall. He made 23. He's the only wicket to fall. Bryden Cass got him out. And so at the moment, I mean, if you work it out, and the current scoring rate, it's not impossible, if they carry on at this rate, that Australia could win this match today in just 2 days.
It is extraordinary. It's flying along. Do you expect England to have anything special, rattle Australia in any way now? Given
well,
what
it's
we saw
the
yesterday.
Pressure of the situation. Yeah, it's the pressure of the situation. And wickets have fallen in clusters here. Not the sort of cluster. I mean, England lost a wheelbarrow load of wickets this afternoon. 9 for 105 in the afternoon session of utter chaos, really. Some poor shots in there. You ask about the Ashes series that I've watched. I'm not sure I've seen quite this amount of poor batting, if I'm honest. I mean, it makes for exciting cricket. But the actual quality of the batting has been substandard for a test match. And as it seems, therefore, more, or it did seem unlikely that both teams would bat so badly twice. And so in a way, it's kind of inevitable that one of them, in this case Australia, is now coming out and playing the way really that they all should have batted throughout this game. But it has been a frenetic match. It's been so much build-up, so much tension, I think, so much pressure on the players. And that really has reflected, I think, the way that the batsmen from both teams have played.
Yeah, 2 days would be remarkable, wouldn't it? Jonathan Agnew, I'll let you get back to the Test Match Special Team. Day two of the first test continues on Five Sports Extra and BBC Sounds. Premier League clubs met in London yesterday to vote on possible ways of replacing the current profit and sustainability rules. The clubs didn't vote for a salary cap. Instead, they've agreed narrowly voted through a new system of financial fair play based on squad costs, which will have to be limited to 85% of a club's revenue, although teams competing in Europe will have to adhere to UEFA's maximum, which is 70%. Wales hosts the All Blacks in Rugby Union's Autumn Internationals this afternoon. There's commentary on Sports Extra 2 from 3:10, and details of all of the weekend's Autumn Internationals are on the BBC Sport website. And in the last few hours, McLaren's Lando Norris has taken pole position for Formula One's Las Vegas Grand Prix, which takes place at 4 a.m. tomorrow morning. Plenty of sport overnight for you.
Thank you, Carthy. Let us hear now from Adrian Childs, who's it's Saturday Live after 9 o'clock. What do you got coming up, Adrian?
Well, we have Michael Sheen with us, absolutely marvellous actor, writer, star of stage and screen, who's busy birthing the Welsh National Theatre. Looking forward to being with him. Also talking armoured MMA. I've got a 3-time world champion, also known as medieval combat sports. It's a frankly alarming pastime. It's like sealed knot style sort of reenactment, it kind of looks like, but they're actually sort of whacking each other with swords and stuff. So I'll be minding my P's and Q's with her. We've got Alex Wood as well. Prolific fraudster in his time, went to jail for it, and now it's trying to make amends by helping the police catch fraudsters. So he's working on behalf of the BBC's Scam Safe Week. We'll also be doing some metal detecting, and we'll get the inheritance tracks of Jason Donovan.
Oh, lovely. That takes me back. Thank you, Adrian. On the way at 9 o'clock this morning. The weather today will be wet. There's rain pushing east across England and Wales. It will be brighter in Scotland and Northern Ireland, but you still get some showers there too.
You're listening today on Radio 4 with Anna Foster in Salford, Simon Jack in London, and at 27 minutes to 9, Charles Carroll has a summary of the news.
Keir Starmer is going to meet other allies of President Zelensky at the G20 summit in Johannesburg to discuss Washington's peace plan for Ukraine. President Trump has given Kiev until Thursday to agree to the proposals, which appear to be tipped heavily in Moscow's favour. Talks have continued throughout the night at the COP30 climate summit in Brazil, which were due to end yesterday. Countries have been unable to agree on whether to mention fossil fuels in the final agreement. One of President Trump's former closest allies, Marjorie Taylor Greene, has announced that she's resigning from the House of Representatives. She fell out with Mr. Trump over his initial reluctance to support the release of documents relating to the late sex offender Jeffrey Epstein. And more than 200 under-16-year-olds will take part in a clinical trial next year to assess the risks and benefits of puberty-blocking drugs for children and young people who are questioning their gender. Scientists will examine the impact of the drugs on the children's physical, social and emotional well-being.
Charles, thank you very much indeed. Now, it's Saturday, and if you've been listening recently, you'll know that we have a panel at this time at just gone 8:30. A moment to step back from the 24-hour news cycle, catch a breath, if you like, and reflect on the big stories of the week and what might matter, what might linger, what might have resonance in the future. And with me today, I've got Tom Whipple, science writer, special correspondent at The Times and presenter of BBC's Inside Science, one of my favourites, and also Claire Barrett, consumer editor of Financial Times, well known to us as well here on the programme. Good morning to you both. Let us start, Tom, if we can, with the COVID inquiry. Now, this has been rumbling on for 3 whole years already. We're only on module 2 out of 5, but this felt like a big week. This was about the government response, what could have, should have been done.
This was the blockbuster week. This was the week when we heard just how bad, good, naughty our politicians are, and also where it seems we have an attempt to adjudicate on that great issue of lockdown.
Well, just take us through what the conclusions were, and then let's try and unpack what we've learned for the future.
The conclusions were, well, if you read Baroness Hallett's opening to it, her conclusions were that both that we should have locked down sooner when we knew we were going to, but also, and this bit gets missed off in the arguments and the sides, because we're all in sides now, she was also quite clear that she felt we could have avoided lockdown if we'd acted sooner. She described February in particular, February 2020, as this wasted month when we were not paying attention.
But is this any use to us, looking back on this? Or is it kind of he said, she said, coulda, woulda, shoulda, you know?
What I think, whenever we hear COVID advice, I think back to a conversation I had in April 2020 with Kate Bingham, the woman who brought all of our vaccines, the great hero of the pandemic. She purchased this suite of vaccines, then we were among the first to get them into people. In April 2020, I said, what's your strategy? And then I said, so how likely is it to work? And she was completely frank. She said, it'll probably fail. 90% of vaccines going to clinics fail. The quickest we've ever done this before is 5 years. So when I look at that, I think at the range of uncertainty that we had then. What we're doing now is we've got, to an extent, certainly in the debate, a retrospectoscope where we're perfectly trying to retrofit. It's like a parlour game. The perfect response to a virus we understand perfectly, which will never come again.
Right. And then try and put numbers around it. For example, £23,000. seems to be overly precise for something like that.
The spurious specificity of it, I thought that was such a mistake.
Okay.
Because we simply don't know, and I think the uncertainty should be embraced.
Claire, your reflections on that, listening to it? I don't know if it, an economic impact that was, you know, we obviously lockdown was very damaging economically.
Well, I mean, we're still paying the price of it, Simon, aren't we? I mean, just like look at the way that government borrowing has ballooned, the interest cost on that. I mean, building up to the budget next week, you know, this is one of the reasons the Chancellor is in as much trouble as she is. But, I mean, when you're looking at the cost of the inquiry, and goodness knows we needed to have one, although other countries have been far faster than we have in learning the lessons. But how prepared are we for the next pandemic, echoing Tom's concerns, and how much money is actually being invested in preparing for that? I think that is a pertinent question.
Well, let's stick with what you just raised there, because obviously next week is budget week. It hasn't even happened yet, but my goodness me, we're all exhausted by it.
It feels like it's been happening for about 3 months.
I mean, the run-up to it has been, in a way, a story in itself.
Yeah, I mean, it really has. I mean, I think the whole country, households, businesses, investors are in brace position for what's going to happen on Wednesday. Now, we're being guided to expect what's being dubbed the smorgasbord of unappetizing,
which means
tax
lots
rises.
Of little microsurgeries, lots of little measures rather than a big one, which they rolled the pitch for last week spectacularly,
and then
withdrew it again, which was income tax.
Yeah, so one big hit to income tax has now been replaced, we think, by lots of smaller taxes, which is a really big risk for the Chancellor, as I've written in the FT today, because there are lots of ways that these very small but concentrated tax rises, predominantly on the wealthy, could either go wrong, be badly received, or potentially be avoided if people's behaviour changes. Now, the one that I'm most worried about from our personal finances point of view is what's going to happen to salary sacrifice. And I'm sure a lot of people listening will think, what? What's that? But it's how most big private sector companies in Britain pay the future pensions of their staff. It's how we're incentivised through the tax system to save more for the future, for our future retirement, because we get a national insurance saving, and so crucially do our companies if they pay a decent sum into our pensions. Now, unfortunately, taxing companies, which is what we're expecting, above a certain level, forcing them to pay national insurance on the future pensions of their workers, is going to have a really chilling effect for millions of people, but far into the future.
Yeah. So basically, kind of discouraging employers from putting more money in, and in fact, you know, making it more difficult for people to save for their own. So that certainly sort of passes the definition of something that will matter in many, many years to come.
It really will matter. And I think that one of the reasons that the Chancellor is perhaps going for it is because so few people in Britain on the street understand pensions and how they work. Now, if we were going to change the triple lock, or if we were going to change the tax-free lump sum that you can take when you retire, that people would understand, because that's something that's affecting money that they've spent decades accumulating that they now have, and the older voters would all rise up in protest. But this is going to hit younger workers, people who are in their 20s, 30s, 40s, 50s, building up money for the future, who are now going to have less going in. One of the ways that companies will react to this, if it does happen on Wednesday, is they'll pay less into workers' workers' pensions. If they're not getting that tax break on the money going in, one in three big employers have told the FT, it's on our front page today, that they would cut. Nearly half have said that they would cut other staff benefits. I mean, that could be anything, Simon, from like maternity, paternity, parental leave, the nicer things that the better employers offer, the ones who are more generous than they have to be with the statutory policies. That is unfortunately what looks like it could go, plus the effects on the jobs market and wage progression in
which has already been stagnating. Just a final thought on the budget from you, Claire. Is it that, you know, is there a silver lining that everyone, as you say, has been holding their breath, both consumers and businesses who might be thinking about investing? I'm not going to do anything before the budget in case there's anything nasty in it. Is there a potential that once you get that passed and we've digested it, things could get a little better and people could breathe a little easier?
Well, I mean, we can see from all the data that consumers and businesses are running scared, whether it's hiring, jobs growth, whether it's the fact that the retail sales figures this week were so dire, consumer confidence has dipped, the household savings rate. I mean, if we do have cash, we're stashing it, not splashing it. So the only person, I think, at the moment who's not cutting spending, frankly, is the Chancellor herself. It's Black Friday on Friday, 2 days after the budget. I think people have been really holding out for a bargain because they're so uncertain about what's happening. Will it get people spending, or will there be more confusion and panic about what the smorgasbord could mean in the future?
I'll see you on the other side when it's all over on Thursday. But Tom, it's interesting, isn't it? Because scientifically, there's a lot of forecasting that goes on. You know, and the economy is a dynamic thing. And sometimes chancellors get it wrong by thinking, if I just change this, then according to my calculations, I'll get this much money. And that people's behaviour changes.
Well, that is the problem with people. They just persist in not fitting into an equation. And I mean, not to be sort of monomaniacal, this was an issue with COVID, with the modellers. Normally, modellers modelled diseases that nobody paid any attention to. But when they did, suddenly the models were interacting with the people who were interacting with the models. I spoke to one modeller who said, look, it's like if you tell people it's going to rain and they all buy umbrellas and then it doesn't rain because they've bought umbrellas. But what I find interesting about the pension things, I did a story 2 weeks ago about the £100,000 cliff edge. So if you earn over £100,000, your taxation goes up to 60%.
The marginal tax rate is 60% because you lose lower allowances once
for just 25 grand, then it goes down again.
Yeah.
And people, we found that there were 30,000 extra people earning 100,000, and almost than there should be. And almost certainly what they were doing is stuffing their pensions because they were deciding, I don't want to go into this where I'm losing far more money, so I'm going to put it into my pension. And now their pensions are going to be taxed more as well.
Yeah, and just a final thought on the budget, Claire. Make or break for Reeves, and if so, and for Starmer as well, are they a job lot?
I think they definitely are. A duo, whether they're a dynamic duo or not, I don't know. I think that anybody who is in charge of our economy at the moment is going to have a very difficult job. But the whole way that this budget and the last one has played out, with months of uncertainty, weak looking decision making or indecision on the big decisions that really matter, and the economic effects that this is having as people, as I said, brace themselves for what's coming, it's no way to run a country.
Claire, Tom, thanks so much. I know you want to talk about quantum computing, Tom, but I'm afraid we don't have time. It's too complicated.
I think not enough time for quantum mechanics.
You'll have to come back and talk to us about that another time, but I'm sure it's going to be a very big deal in the future, but not quite today.
17 minutes to nine. Let's head to South Africa. Chris Mason, our political editor, is there, as is the Prime Minister, Sir Keir Starmer. Is the G20 summit later. But Chris, conversations due to be happening on the sidelines about the ceasefire deal, which the US has put to Ukraine, which really doesn't match anything that Sir Keir Starmer and the Coalition of the Willing have been pushing so far.
Yeah, morning to you, Anna. I'm on a bus as I make my way across Johannesburg, so fingers crossed this line is resilient. Here we have a G20 where Donald Trump has made a point of not coming, which is very rare for an American delegation not to be present at an event like this. And yet, he is shipping all of the most important conversations. So the Prime Minister going into a sequence of meetings this evening with fellow allies of Ukraine and attempting to publicly praise the President's willingness to pursue peace, whilst at the same time, I think there's a widespread private horror at the terms that have been set out in this peace plan, and Europe collectively, again, trying to mould America in a direction that it is comfortable with and that Kyiv is comfortable with. And the next few days, I think, will be crucial in whether that is remotely possible.
Yeah, and even though, Chris, he's on the world stage at the moment, which is a crucial part of his job, what's happening at home is very much on his mind. And you were talking to him about that just yesterday.
So I think that the Prime Minister's seeking to portray a kind of domestic dividend of his globe-trotting. I'm struck, having followed this Prime Minister since he assumed office, 14, 15 months ago, that he can come across as being more at home abroad. He does cut a comfortable figure on the global stage, and we've seen that most demonstrably, I think, with the relationship, the unlikely relationship that he's built up with President Trump, which he very much may need to lean into in the next couple of days. I think there's a keen awareness for the Prime Minister and those around him of the pressure he's under, not least from his own side, from Labour MPs desperate to see him succeed and yet really fearful that the government is unpopular and he is even more unpopular than that ahead of the budget that we were just reflecting on in the last couple of minutes. So he tries to lean into that sense abroad of what he is bringing home. So that trip to a railway depot here in Johannesburg yesterday, pointing at trains that were assembled in Derby, but keenly aware of the pressure he's under. We always talk, don't we, on this programme about political leaders under pressure, because so often they are, but we shouldn't underestimate the scale of the pressure the Prime Minister is under. And that's what's motivated the various stories we've seen from the briefings from those who support him, the briefings from those who don't in the last few weeks. They're all symptomatic of that awareness of the political predicament that he's in. Mm.
Chris, thank you. You'll be glad to hear the line held up on the bus. Much more from Chris to come with the Prime Minister in South Africa. And particularly those talks, as he was saying, on the margins of the G20 summit as well.
14 minutes to 9 o'clock.
Let's talk about something a little different, because it is Saturday morning and it's a little bit more relaxed. And if you can believe it, Toy Story, which has been one of the big films of the last three decades, is up to number 5. It's not out till next summer. Created by Pixar Animated Studios for Disney. But people are talking about the trailer of it already, which features a new threat to the toys. And this time, it's an iPad.
Hi there, I'm Lilypad. Let's play.
Oh, parents everywhere will be kind of shuddering at the sound of that and thinking, yes, I recognise this. And the teaser asks the question, is the age of toys now over in favour of that kind of thing? What will happen to Jesse and Woody and Buzz and the whole gang in this particular film? Well, Frank Cottrell Boyce, children's author, friend of the programme, has been reflecting on that and really how the Toy Story franchise continues to hold up a mirror to the changing human experience.
It's 30 years since the first Toy Story movie. Its first audience has by now long put away childish things. After all, that's what Andy, the actual owner of the toys, has done. He's grown up, gone to college, left home and toys behind. And what do you do if you're a toy and your owner doesn't want to play with you anymore? What are we for when we've outlived our apparent purpose? It's a question that cuts deep, and it's a question that's examined hilariously and heartbreakingly over and over again in the Toy Story films. Think of the moment in Toy Story 1 when Buzz Lightyear, who thinks he's a swashbuckling interplanetary hero ready to go to infinity and beyond, discovers he's a toy, one of thousands meant to be played with by a child. Or the moment when Woody hears the Woody song and discovers he's a rootin' tootin' cowboy with a whole history he's never known. In most stories about toys, it's the child's imagination that brings life to the toys. Think of Christopher Robin and Winnie the Pooh, but here it's different. Andy doesn't give them life. He doesn't even know they're alive. Andy gives them purpose. And then he takes it away. So what do? Stinky Pete recommends sterile immortality in a kind of toy museum, like the tech billionaires of Silicon Valley who want to freeze or upload themselves after death. But for Woody, the answer always lies in looking out for each other. The cure for existential angst is service. My friend Priya reminded me of the remarkable moment in episode 4 when the child Bonnie starts kindergarten. She's lost, she's lonely, but Woody, like a guardian angel, has followed her and secretly inspires her to make her own toy out of a plastic spoon. Toys making toys, like robots making robots, or AI replicating itself. Toy Story 1 was the first completely computer-generated movie. It was the magical curtain up on the digital age. The films are the story of what happens when one child grows out of his toys. But more and more, I'm hearing the phrase, children don't play with toys anymore. They've ditched their toys for screens. Toy Story 5 will introduce a new character, a tablet called Lilypad. Are we on our way to a digital toyless infinity and beyond? What will we do there? I think Woody probably has the answer.
You know, I just listening to that, you just reminded how the sheer quality of those movies, and they are laugh out loud funny for kids and adults. My favourite bit of all of them, and I can't remember which one, I think it might have been one, was when Mr. Potato Head put both his eyes on one side of his face and said, "Hey, look, Picasso." I thought that was absolutely
he
hilarious.
He is the underrated comedy character of the whole franchise, I would say. He just appears, one funny thing, and then he's gone again for the whole of the rest of the film, but he changes the direction.
It's an interesting what Frank Rick brings up there about how AR, you know, can you imagine, it was the first fully computerized animation film, and you know, I'm willing to bet they're having a go at doing a Toy Story, getting AI to do the whole thing, and I just wonder whether they will be able to capture that amazing human storytelling quality that those movies do possess. And I cannot imagine, believe that it's 30 years ago. That is a terrible statistic for the morning. Anyway, it is 9:09. Let us talk about the Spanish singer-songwriter Rosalía. Now, she's released what is fast becoming what many people think is the album of the year. It's called Lux, that's L-U-X with a Spanish accent, and it's sung in 13 different languages, and it's addressing aspects of religious mysticism, and it's not what you might expect to take the pop world by storm. But Rosalía is no typical artist. Our Spain correspondent Guy Hedgeco has been discovering more about the musician, who started out as a flamenco singer and is now conquering pop around the world.
Berghain, the first single from Rosalía's new album, Lux. On this track, she's accompanied by the London Symphony Orchestra and Björk. Proof, if anyone needed, that this Catalan artist is now musical royalty. The album is a kaleidoscopic blend of classical and opera with traditional music and electronica. Grande Rosalía! Rosalía already had a passionate following. This is her being chased through central Madrid earlier this month, just before she announced the release of the album. And now she has a legion of new fans, with everyone from the Spanish Prime Minister to Andrew Lloyd Webber praising Lux. The artist herself has described this as an album about feminine mysticism. It took her 3 years to make, partly because she was researching the subject matter and learning to sing in the 13 languages she uses on the album, including Arabic, Ukrainian, Latin and Japanese, as she told BBC Radio 6 Music.
Each song is inspired on the story of a saint, specifically women saints and women from all across the world. So when I was maybe trying to channel more a story that has to do with Joan of Arc, then I would sing in French.
Few young people go to church in Spain. Yet Rosalía's contemporary take on spiritual matters, one song is titled God's a Stalker, seems to have struck a chord. Xavi Sancho is a music writer for El País newspaper. He says Rosalía's interests extend far beyond Catholicism.
Some people here in Spain who really wanted to link her to some sort of like comeback of traditional values and disaffected youth and all that, which is not, I believe it's not the case. She's like someone trying to find her inner self through the readings and the learnings of saints, female saints in many religions.
This is the latest creative leap for an artist who loves to jump from one genre to another. Rosalía insists her most recent stylistic shift is a logical one.
Of course, I've always loved classical music. Definitely, you know, Puccini's as a reference of the project, or in general, Albéniz, Falla, Granados. There's so much classical music as an inspiration, Bach, Chopin, blah, blah, blah. But all of that, it's been part of my life since I started studying music.
I'm at the Escola Superior de Música de Catalunya, a music academy in Barcelona, where Rosalía was a student. Here, she studied a variety of genres, including classical music and flamenco. Flamenco is the one musical thread that has run throughout Rosalía's career. Nuria Sempere is the director of the academy, and she remembers Rosalía as a driven student.
She was really dedicated in all the activities she was doing. Her main study was flamenco singing, so it was clear that she was not only singing what her teachers proposed her to sing, she was going further.
With looks, the 33-year-old Rosalía appears to have found what all artists dream of: commercial success, critical adulation, and personal expression.
Finishing that, appropriately enough, because Sarah Quinn, violinist and chair of the board at the London Symphony Orchestra, was one of the musicians who worked on Looks with Rosalía, is here with me in the studio. And I have to say, moving just a little bit from side to side as that tape ended. Tell us about this, Sarah. I mean, part Puccini, part Billie Eilish, pop classical, 13 language, 12 female cells. What's going on and how did you get involved?
Well, I think it's an incredible album and everybody's talking about it, and I can fully understand why just listening to that clip now was bringing it all flooding back. The LSO has a long history of recording. You know, it's in our DNA and we've worked with many artists, but I think this particular album was really particularly collaborative. And I think this idea of blending Rosalía's vocals, which are extraordinary.
Yeah. Does she have a really different quality here? Because the LSO does, for, you know, Elton John's tunes and whatever, and we'll have, you know, Van Halen meet to the London Symphony Orchestra. What did she bring to the proceedings and why do you think it's catching on so much?
I think this idea of blending her vocals with this symphonic orchestral sound is a fascinating thing that we've done here. And even in the sessions, she was creating in the moment. So we had these wonderful orchestral arrangements that had been written for us. Mm-hmm. And yet, even listening to them, she was coming in saying, you know, can you try it this way? Can you do it the way that I'm singing? And we would try to replicate that. And of course, we can change style at the drop of a hat. So it was a wonderful thing to be a part of.
Mm. Did you get the sense that she was driving the creative process? I mean, she's kind of got real authorship of this and she knows what she's doing and got a clear vision?
I think very much so. But I think you combine an artist like Rosalía and the LSO and you get something really special. Mm. And I think you hear that on this album.
I suppose there's been other artists who've tried to kind of do this. I'm thinking of Queen, early sort of Queen records. There was a bit of that. And there was something slightly high camp about it. Is there something like, is that a good description?
I'm not sure I'd agree totally with that. I think it's one of those things, I think if you use the orchestra in the way that she has wanted to, you have that wonderful texture and colour, you've individual instruments, you've got this vast orchestral sweep. I think there's imagination there and it's a really great listen.
Does the LSO, does everyone tut when the pop stars come in? I heard this great story about one pop star who basically thought they were being looked down on by the orchestra, and it was at lunchtime went away and tuned second violins, one of their strings down. When they came back, he went, second violin, I think your string's flat. Do you like working with pop stars?
We love working with pop stars. It's a really fascinating part of the job. And it's something that really drew me to the orchestra, this sort of work, recording and live performance.
And how much of that stuff do you do? Do you session recordings as well in studios and all that kind of stuff?
Yes, we're in the studio regularly. You can find us, all the studios in London. We recorded the album here.
Mm. And will there be live performances as well of any of this? Do you know?
I'm sure there will be, but I don't know the details of that. I'm sure we'll watch this space.
Okay. Well, that is the Spanish singer-songwriter Rosalía, and her album is called Looks, featuring, as you just heard, Sarah Quinn and the London Symphony Orchestra. And I don't know what to make of that mashup myself.